Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, August 20th, 2018. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250. Access code is 449-389. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find our banners on the right-hand side of our website. which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, tonight's scripture reading is going to be in the Gospel of John. We're going to pick up where we left off. We're going to read quite a few verses tonight. I keep looking for a place to break and try to read maybe 15 verses or so, but this might be twice as many as normal because I don't want to break the story up, and so we'll take it from there. Okay, well, you know what? Maybe we'll break this in half. I'm looking. We'll see how it goes. Okay, Gospel of John, chapter 5, verse 1. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is at Jerusalem by the sheep market a pool, which is called in the Hebrew tongue Bethesda, having five porches. In these lay a great multitude of impotent folks, of blind, halt, withered, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel went down at a certain season into the pool and troubled the water. Whosoever then first, after the troubling of the water, stepped in, was made whole of whatsoever disease he had. And a certain man was there, which had an infirmary 38 years. When Jesus saw him lie and knew that he had been now a long time in that case, he saith unto him, Wilt thou be made whole? The impotent man answered him, Sir, I have no man, when the water is troubled, to put me into the pool. But while I am coming down, another step down before me. Jesus saith unto him, Rise, take up thy bed, and walk. And immediately the man was made whole, and took up his bed, and walked. And on the same day was the Sabbath. The Jews therefore said unto him that was cured, It is the Sabbath day. It is not lawful for thee to carry thy bed. He answered them, He that made me whole, the same saith unto me, Take up thy bed and walk. Then they asked him, What man is that which saith unto thee, Take up thy bed and walk? And he that was healed wist not who it was, for Jesus had conveyed himself away in a multitude in his being in that place. Afterward, Jesus findeth him in the temple, and saith unto him, Behold, thou art made whole, sin no more, lest a worse thing come unto thee. The man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus which had made him whole. And therefore did the Jews persecute Jesus and sought to slay him, because he had done these things on the Sabbath day. Okay, we're going to break there, and we'll pick up the other half of this story, because there's a further conversation here. We'll pick that up next Monday. Okay, let's see. All right, we don't have a particular topic. A few things I'd like to just make a note of and get out there. First of all, I'd like to expand our Monday night program. You know, right now we have a radio that transmits our program, our Monday night program. Some people come and just listen to the radio. Some people download the MP3s. We post the MP3s, of course, at the end of every night, every Monday night. And some people post it, download it during the week and maybe listen on the way to work or whenever they might listen to this. But I'd like to do is I'd like to expand this even further. I know we've had some people who were broadcasting us through other stations that they were broadcasting from. I don't know if they're still doing it, but there were a few. But what I'd like to do is I'd like to expand ourselves to other radios and get some further cast and broadcasting out. So I'd like to maybe a few people can volunteer to run this project to see what we can do there. We also have YouTube news. I know Ali was sick for a while. He's the guy who's running that and put everything together for us on that. Hopefully he's feeling better, and maybe we can get into that, get that going, get a YouTube news program going. I don't know if we want to get something every day, but at least every week. I think every day, maybe. There's a lot that we have to talk about, and a lot we have talked about. We can go in and take a lot of our older calls, or recorded calls, and pull out pieces of different conversations or maybe some teachings that took place. And we can do this over the YouTube in small pieces. I don't know how long, maybe 30-minute pieces, and put something out every day. But anyway, anybody who would like to volunteer to work with us on this project, there are other talk programs out there. We used to be on a platform called TalkShoe. And, you know, I kind of like TalkShoe. We left it because we started to run into some problems there. We couldn't get clear, you know, broadcasting going there. And so eventually we had to leave it. But I'm sure they probably repaired that problem. I'd like to not rebroadcast, but simulcast through TalkShoe, where people even in TalkShoe could actually maybe ask some questions from that venue and get it tied into this venue here that we're on here in Free Conference Call. I know there was a program called Pal Talk I used to be on many, many years ago. We should go take a look at that and see how that's coming along. And that was really an interesting setup that they had, because they had, it was a worldwide program. They had literally they had thousands of rooms, actually, but hundreds of rooms were open at any given time. And, you know, you can look, go down and look through the list of different categories and then different rooms and the list of things being discussed and go into a room and participate in a conversation. And that was really good. Maybe we can link into that. And I'm sure there's a whole bunch of other talk platforms or maybe radio platforms that we can, you know, rebroadcast. And again, simulcast is a better word. I like to simulcast. Everything I'm talking about, we're talking about simulcasting. But in order to do simulcasting, first of all, we need somebody, kind of a program director or something, whatever we want to call that person, who will help us to put these things together, find out the technology of how we might want to make the hookup, work things out. Maybe Carl can help us on the technical side. Maybe others can too. And get this thing going where we can get the word out of what we're doing and what we're teaching to a greater audience. There used to be some programs that wanted to, you know, simulcast us. And again, so we can get out there and see what programs are out there that would want to simulcast us. But again, in simulcasting, that does require someone in that other platform working and making the connection into here, our call here on Free Conference Calling. And each one of those systems probably should have two people working it, so that if one ran into technical abilities, another can pick it up. But that's a detail. Anyway, if anybody's interested in trying to work this program out, help us seek out volunteers to work with this program, put a plan together, and go out and make it happen. And again, I don't think Gerard's here tonight yet, at least not right now. Anyway, I know he mentioned to me that Ollie was ill for a while. I don't know if Ollie's here tonight. If he's here, maybe he can get into the queue, see how he's feeling, and if he's ready to get going on the YouTube news,
information.
NLA News. Excuse me?
I went and took Ollie to lunch today, John, and he's
How's
getting a lot better. They finally figured out what was wrong with him and gave him the right medicines to take, and he's getting his strength back. And that was part of what I tried to do today, was get him out and get him, you know, in the area. So he's feeling better, but he's not over the hump yet.
Okay, were you partnershipping with him on this?
I will help him in any way I can, but I wasn't committing to it.
Do need to do is find a partnership, someone to partnership with him. You know, we try to get all of the leadership at National Liberty Alliance in a partnership role in case one had to take off for a while, got sick for a while, or whatever the case may be. You know, Gerard and I have worked together. If I'm not around, Gerard can pick things up and vice versa. I know I talked with Jan about this with him, and I don't know, I talked... Jan's not in tonight, is he?
No, I don't think so, and I'm here to cover. And okay. You know that I will be up there talking and helping Ollie as much as I can, but we do need another person, preferably
right,
one that's in Fort Collins, yes.
Right, yeah, so if something happens and someone has to take a week or two or three off, there's someone to keep things going. So we've got to work that out. And I know we maybe Gary hasn't been that that active lately. He's been ill actually for quite a few years with a few different situations and problems, but he's kind of straightened a lot of that out, I believe. And maybe he'll take a bigger role once he's back in. Again, I don't know if he's here tonight. I don't know if you want to get into the queue if you hear Gary. Well, actually, if you're interested, we'll talk about it. It should be a private conversation. We'll get something going with Jan. But anyway, anybody interested in kind of spearheading this program, get a hold of Jan. You can find his number under directory on nationalliberty.org. Just look through the drop-down box under directory and or click on directory, and you should be able to go to a page, and Jan's phone number and email should be towards the top of the page. Make a connection with him, and then we'll try to get a few people together. Hopefully we'll get a couple people, and we'll have a conference call. I'll be involved with that, and Gerard, and I'll put a lot of ideas that I kind of have in mind and see once if we can't execute some of those or add to them and get other ideas going. But we really do need to kind of get out there to expand ourselves further. I do see that the YouTube programming is exploding, especially Q, you know, so a lot of things on Q, but it's not the only one. Anybody who's really reporting and doing a good job at it, and there are a few of them out there that I listen to. Matter of fact, we have a list of those that we kind of support because they support us too, but they really bring out some, you know, news, and they're very consistent. They're on the cutting edge, and a lot of new things bringing a bond, you know, to us. But anyway, you can find that under. Where do I have it? I may have it under the Q page. Let me see. Yeah, if you click on Q on the blue bar, you'll find a few places. There's X22 Report. There's You Are Free TV. There's Qniverse, Truth and Art TV, SGT. Screen Hoopla, Greg Hunter, and David Zubelik. We also have a page on the activities and things of the White House and a focus in on Fox Business. So we have a channel, you know, to there also, what's going on business in the business world, so to speak. But anyway, these are channels that we have found that are pretty consistent, bring some good information, and is on the cutting edge. So people who want to maybe listen in on this would be good. But again, these places, not all of them, but most of them are supporting us directly. Some of them I just put up there because they put out a lot of good information. We should make contact with them, maybe get some interviewing going, you know. The X22 has a big or a decent-sized listenership. And they're very involved, kind of a sophisticated level. X22 really puts out some great reports on a daily basis, numerous reports throughout the day. They do a lot of interviews. Maybe we can make a connection with them, see if they're interested in interviewing us, and making a connection into that, you know, X22, and get their support also. You Are Free TV, we've been interviewed on that station a couple of times, and again, some good stuff. Qniverse also, they support us. And a few others. But anyway, we want to add to this list on the one hand, but we want to really get the word out. These YouTube pages are pretty popular, and so they get a lot of hits, and a lot of people, you know, become members and get, you know, the daily programs from them. So we need to get out there more. So anybody interested in spearheading that, you know, get a hold of Jan. Okay, let's see what else we have here. Okay, we want to move forward and push forward on our sheriff's project. Really, anybody, if you haven't given yet, either on our sheriff's project or our, you know, donations for funding court case that we're going forward with, and we have collected enough money on that. We're now pushing for the sheriffs. So please, if you can afford $50 or more, a one-time donation, if you haven't given, please consider giving and help us reach that mark. We've really got to get up about $58,000 to really get that sheriff's project going. I was listening to a speech by the president in the White House and talking to a lot of people, border patrols and, you know, other police, you know, what would you call them, agencies. You know, he was really pushing a lot of things on this particular, you know, speech he was given. And I kind of lost my train of thought here. I'm not sure where I was heading to on this. But anyway, we do have to get the word out. We got to get to as many people as possible. And we have to get going, really, whatever we can do on YouTube. Okay, let's see what else we have here. If it comes to mind where I was heading to with the speech that the president was giving, I'll sort of pipe it in, but I kind of lost my train of thought there. All right, like I mentioned, we're writing the case right now, which we'll be filing that case. Oh, the sheriffs. That's where I was heading to, education-wise on the sheriffs. He had some sheriffs there also. And I realize even more so than ever, and every time I think about this, and especially listen to something like that I was listening to, the necessity for these individuals to become educated in the Constitution. It's not going to be, it is enough to some degree, but in the long term, it's not enough just to get the courts back. We also have to get the sheriffs to be thinking properly. We got to get these people to understand that they're not to go to attorneys and lawyers in order to discover what the Constitution is. They need to know that before they take office. And so we really got to get them educated. And anyway, listening into that particular thing, the speech with the president and the people he was talking with and so on and so forth, it really made it clear in my mind how much they really do need this. So again, this is an important project. It's going to cost us $58,000 altogether. But what our plan is to get 20 books into the hands of every single sheriff in America. Now, we would anticipate that they would hand these out to their deputies. It also refers back to National Liberty Alliance, so they can come take courses here. But it does really cover a lot of stuff. Anybody who hasn't read that particular booklet that we put together, you can get a copy of that on our front page. It's called The Sheriff's Handbook. As you're reading down, you'll see it. We added some new stuff on the front page over the past few weeks, so anybody who hasn't read the front page in a while, you might want to go back and view the front page a little bit and read some things, and new things that we put together. We explained this particular program and the costs involved with this particular program for the sheriffs. I think once we get to about $35,000, at that point we can order the books, and then we're going to trust then that we're going to be able to finish the collection for the rest of it, so that we can mail these books out. I kind of took a guess at this that it's going to run about 35 cents a booklet, okay, to have it printed up and shipped, you know, to one address here in New York. And then here in New York, we would have to then package it up, making 3,100 packages, putting 20 in each package, and then mailing it out, maybe put a letter together, a cover letter or something, and then mail it out to the sheriffs. And again, you know, the idea is to get the handbooks into the hands of all of the sheriffs and his deputies. If we kind of run into a problem and don't have enough money to really, let's say we order the booklets and we're unable to, and we haven't collected enough money yet to get these booklets mailed out, or we have a certain amount of money and we need more, whatever the case may be, what we might do then is ask for volunteers in each county to assist us, and we'll figure out the cost factors But maybe we would send the booklets to them. We wouldn't really have to charge them for the books. The books are already paid for, but for the shipping, maybe. Maybe they'd give us $10 for the shipping, the packaging, and the shipping, get it to them, and then they would deliver it, directly to the sheriff themselves. In that situation, maybe we would send out 25 books instead of 20. So at least the person also that's going to bring these books to the sheriffs could maybe keep a hold of a couple of books themselves. But also, if they need more, you know, they can let the sheriff know, we can get them more, and just have to let us know, and we'll try to get them out. Again, we're looking to print about 100,000 books, and at 35 cents a piece, that's $35,000. We figure there's 3,000, let's say 3,100 counties, 3,100 sheriffs, we'll say, okay, at 20 books each. So that's 62,000 books. So let's say it's 65,000, okay? So we got 65,000. We got 35,000 more books than what we need. But that's not really the case, because some sheriffs are going to want more. Also, I have a feeling some people might want to buy these. Maybe we'll sell them out to people also after we, of course, first make sure we get these to the sheriffs first. But whatever, we will get those booklets out into the world one way or the other and have to get people reading it. But we want to get into the hands of the right people. We don't want people to get hold of these books and kind of just stick them on a shelf and let them collect dust. We need to have them put into, the shirt pockets of the individuals who mostly need to know these things. These books also, it'll probably be a good book also to give out to a person running for office. But anyway, we'll expand on those ideas later. The first order of business is to get about 35,000 so that we can order the books. Once we get the books ordered, then, we'll move along as we continue and get this project going. Okay, so again, everybody, please see what you can give. Those people who have already given, we want to thank them, but those who have not given, we're asking them to really sit down and consider donating to this worthy cause. And also consider, supporting us on a monthly basis for $5 a month or more. That's giving up a cup of coffee and a bagel once a month. And there you go. There's your $5. $5 a month. Everyone can afford $5 a month. Almost everyone, anyway. All right. Are you aware, Terry, of any other announcements or anything? I don't know. Is Crystal out there? She may have an update.
Crystal was on earlier for just a moment, and then she disappeared before I could catch her.
Okay.
And I'm going back through the email. I forgot to do that part because I thought Jan was going to show up in a little bit. But I'm going through there looking for questions and such things. And I haven't found anything really solid yet, but I have a few more to go through.
Okay. All right. Well, if we see Crystal come in, let's, pull her up to see if she's got a report. Gerard,
okay.
You got anything you want to report before we get moving?
No, I'm good. I just got in, so I'm a little disheveled, but we're good. We
okay,
got Jim
we'll
and the thing.
Get shoveled
is Brent
back
here?
In. I don't know.
Here?
I don't see him. I don't see him. Have you seen Brent?
No, I haven't seen guy? Brent, but I do see Jim. He was in there as the program
yeah, Jim's
started.
Jim's in the
so
call right now.
He might have. He might have some announcement.
Okay. All right. Are you ready to take the controls, Gerard? We'll take a first caller, and you want to take the controls or what? And if we
yeah.
see, if we see Brent coming in, just give us an alert there, and we'll move over to him for a half hour, whatever he wants, 20 minutes. And
will do.
Also keep an eye out for Crystal. Okay, I'll let you hit the buttons. We got a first call to Jim. Gerard, you got the controls.
All right. Anybody else wants to get in now because...
Yeah, there's nobody there now, so let's get
otherwise
in.
Otherwise, we'll close early. Okay.
Star 6.
There we go. Okay. Go ahead, Jim. You've been unmuted.
Hi, how's it going there?
Good.
I just wanted to let you all know that when I called in, it said that the number you have dialed is not in service. And so I hung up, and I did it again. I called back, and then I just hung on for a second, and next thing you know, the lady came on and said, you know, you reached a pre-conference call. But originally, like it was hacked or something, you know, it said the number you dialed cannot be completed.
Are you dialing Skype, Jim?
No, I'm right on a regular old cell phone.
No. I have trouble with Skype connecting sometimes. Like I put the number in and it acts like it's the wrong number. And I just attribute that to Skype or the internet or something, you know. Well, maybe they got a glitch.
Well, I'm just thinking maybe somebody put that in there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
One of our friends, you know, as a way to stymie us, you know, as usual.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, so that's why I got the queue. I wondered if anybody else would call in and say that they experienced that.
And by the way, Jim, I know you've been trying to get a hold of me. It's been a really hectic week for me. As a matter of fact, a couple of weeks, really hectic. And I really got to focus in on this court case. But I know we still have those two habeas corpuses hanging around that we're going to complete. I just haven't been able to get to it. But hopefully this week we'll connect.
Okay, call me anytime. And so anyway, seeing as we're talking about the sheriffs, you know, wouldn't it be feasible to kind of send out some of these sheriff books to some sheriffs that we know are going to be favorable towards them? So this way we can kind of seed the pond a little bit and see if that can stir up.
Yeah, but we have to print them first. I mean, you know, they're way too expensive to print if you print only a few at a time or a couple of dozen or a couple of hundred. The more you print, the cheaper it is. And so the big number, the real big cutoff, I think, is 100,000. I mean, yeah, you can get them even cheaper if you do, you know, 200,000 or a half a million. A half a million, if you did a half a million or a million, I know the people who are doing the the people that are doing the constitutional books, and they sell them very cheap, by the way, but they print a million at a time. I was talking with them because they were kind of interested in reprinting the books that we had for, you know, jurors and sheriffs and judges and so on. So they were printing like a million at a time, and with that they get a really good deal. But we're not at that level where we can print off a million of these things. But clearly we need at least 100,000 to get out. When we did the other books, I think that's what we did order was 100,000, if I remember. Yeah.
Well,
right.
I'm not against that. I'm just seeing that if we, you know, it would behoove us to get it out there right now because it may start up, you know, it may start a little brush fire of freedom, you know.
Well, no doubt about that. That's exactly why. No, that was the time. This is why I'm pushing it. I mean, really, we should be ordering them now. We don't have the money yet now, but you know, so let's get the money up quickly as we can. Everybody needs to realize how important this particular project is to educate our sheriffs. And we need to get them out now, and I really need to get this book done and the third test done, you know, course, shall I say, the third course. But again, you know, all these things kind of work together anyway because it's all part of the book ultimately, and it's all part of the course ultimately. So even though I'm not working directly on those two items, indirectly, I am. It's just that I have to couch them different when I put them into a course or put them into a book. So pretty much everything in the sheriff's handbook will be in the book or in the course, and a lot of things. It's a lot of stuff. But education is the key. Now is the time to get the message out. With what's going on, I think our timing for going into the courts is just perfect. And if we can get these sheriff's books out there now, all together at one, I think it's a really, really a potent time for this.
Yeah.
All right, anything else, Jim?
So did you hear anything from our friends in Central Albany, you know, down at the courthouse?
Yeah, I heard, what do they call it? Silence. That's what I heard. Loud silence. It's kind of surprising
okay.
that they have not responded. Really, really surprising.
So it's like the other shoe to drop or something. Along
well,
that
yeah,
line.
You know,
right.
look, at they said they made a big thing rushing towards June 19th, and then with my last paper I put in, ever since that, it's been dead silent. And but they were going to, the judge was clear, he was going to make a ruling on the 19th, June 19th. Well, June 19th came and went, July 19th came and went, and guess what? August 19th came and went, and they haven't done nothing yet. I'm thinking of writing to the judge, you know, what's going on? You know, we need to get this case going, you know? So.
Yep. I mean, if he's got a reason for delay, then we're entitled to know the reason.
Yeah.
Well, they don't have any hard and fast rules on that, right, John, as far as the court rules
well, look,
on a decision. I mean, I know it's customary.
If a man keeps his words, you figure he's going to keep his words, you know? Well, I'm going to get a ruling in this on the 19th, you know?
Yeah, but they don't have any rules that the judge is bound by, do they? I mean, they make a decision when they make a decision.
It's a good question. I got to look for it to see that. I'm not sure.
I've never seen it.
Yeah, they wouldn't put a rule in to restrict the judge unless they had to, you know, put him in a box somewhere. So, I don't know. All right, anyway.
I'm just thinking we should try to be proactive, if anything. We can, you know, it can only work in our advantage then.
I know, look, at some of the cases we did, John, in the state courts, they took a couple months to rule.
Yeah, but look, at this was on a decision of having the case thrown out under Rule 12. I mean, what is there to think about? What is there to think about?
Well, your last paper.
Well, I guess.
It kind of like you hit a brick wall, I guess. So
what are we supposed to do?
Sit here and twiddle our thumbs till they make a decision? Or
Well, that's what we're doing. But no, we're moving on to another case. So.
How about we entertain filing that injunction because of the fact that they're holding it up? So we'll just say, listen, if you want to just issue this injunction, you guys can take forever to do it. You know,
well,
we're fine with that.
They don't have the authority to think of anything because there's no reason for Rule 12 to come into play here, and that is that's the absolute fact.
I understand that, but doesn't Rule 12 or doesn't the injunction also come with a monetary daily fine or something like that?
Well, that's true. Yeah, it does.
Well, you know, that's what I mean. You know, sometimes when you prime the pump, you get water out. You know,
well, so. You don't have to have a fine with an injunction. You could say that you can't uphold that until the case is done, right? Or did we put a fine
in? Well, the injunction, if they don't give an injunction once we file for an injunction, and if they just ignore it, for every day that we get damaged, we had a fine, you know, a number in there.
Right, right. So we have to file it before we can do that, right. But it has to be filed, I see.
Right.
Yeah, I think the number we were toying with was 1,000 a day.
Okay.
That's what I remember seeing. But we never filed it, and I was kind of a little disappointed, but nevertheless, you know, everything in its time, put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to see what's happening. I know there's people listening that would like to know. So,
well, the other thing
is... You know,
we went in as people in this case. We didn't go in as grand jury or anything. The grand jury can come in and say, you know, this is show cause why we shouldn't hold you in contempt for not ruling on this. The grand jury says you have a duty.
Well, the grand jury did come in and sort of say something similar to that. And
on the gun case?
They came in as a friend of the court. Yeah, friend of the court.
Well, now they're really confused. They don't know what to do.
Amicus Curiae. Yeah. All right, let's take our next caller.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Thanks, Tim.
Okay. It's Connecticut, Constance. You've been unmuted.
Hello? Hello?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yes.
Go ahead, Constance.
Hi, this is Connie. I'm in Connecticut. I'm calling because Tanya McCash, who's also a member of NLA, she's been fighting a battle where she violated a protective order that she never received a copy of or knew about. Anyway, she's been fighting this battle for a year. And in late May, Judge Manley in Santa Clara County declared her incompetent because of her legal strategy. She moved the case out of Santa Clara into Alameda. Then she tried to move it into federal court. She was supposed to satisfy two criteria. She didn't satisfy both of the criteria, so they remanded it back to Alameda County. Santa Clara County would not stop proceeding with the case. They kept on giving her notices to appear, which she did. But so after Judge Manley declared her incompetent to stand trial because of her legal strategy, she didn't file an appeal.
Incompetent for a legal strategy.
Huh?
Is that what you said? Incompetent for a legal strategy?
Yeah, she actually named Judge Manley in a common law civil lawsuit in probate court. And I talked to the person who served him back in June. So he didn't appear in two or three of her appearances where she had to go before a judge since June. And she thought it was because he was being named as a defendant and she was a plaintiff in a civil lawsuit in probate court. So he showed up last Friday, and he told her he wanted her to take psychiatric drugs, and she said no. And then he told her he wanted her to have a public defender, and she said no. And he said, okay, then you're going to jail for 3 weeks. She's currently in jail at, what's the name of that? Elmwood Correctional Facility. So number one, I told her that she should request a jurisdiction hearing, get the public defender, let him argue the case on the point that, number one, she was never aware of that protection order. They don't have any proof of service or anything. Number two.
Well, that's the key. You know, they have to prove that she was aware of that. She doesn't have to prove that she's not aware of it. They have to prove that she was aware of it and violated it. So that's the key here. And if there was nothing where someone has give a sworn statement that they served her with this paper or whatever the case may be, then nothing exists. There's nothing to take her to court on, period.
Well, that's what I told her in the beginning. That should be the main argument. But she was
absolutely
trying to She was trying to do all this common law jurisdiction stuff and moving it and moving it and moving it. And I said, if you argue the case on its facts, and at one point she said the court did acknowledge that she wasn't aware of it, and that alone should indicate that she was accused of a crime. She didn't even know that she was violating a protective order because
right.
she wasn't.
It shows that there's no proof of claim. Period. If they have to, if they're going to make a claim that she has been, had some service of some kind of an order, and she violated that order again, they have to prove that it was given. So yeah, that
right.
is the key. But she didn't make that as a lead point.
She tried to argue that, but they kept on trying to argue that she has mental and psychological issues. And at one point, Judge Manley said, I want you to, you're court ordering, you have to go see a psychiatrist. She knew it wasn't going to go her way. No matter how normal she acted, they weren't going to write it in her favor because, I mean, she went through a really bad divorce and everything, and similar things happened. So anyways, Judge number one, she wasn't aware of the protective order. Number two, Judge Manley is a defendant, and she is the plaintiff. So he can't remain objective yet he presided over her case on Friday and sent her to jail for 3 weeks. And number three,
wow, that's pretty dangerous and bold, huh?
Well, listen, you said she had hearings and he didn't show up, right? In other words, she sued him and there was court hearings and she was suing him and he wasn't there. Or his attorney, nobody was there for him?
No. She had court appearances related to this criminal case and he didn't appear twice.
Was there a consequence for his not appearing?
Yeah, but she was suing him at the same time.
Probably moving towards a default, right?
Look, she was suing him at the same time. So I don't know how she proceeded. So if she's got a suit, there's going to be hearings in that suit, and he has to show up or his lawyer has to show up. So he didn't show up to her things because he could not.
Yeah, but there has to be a consequence.
Let me finish.
Or something.
Look at it. When he didn't show up for something because she was suing him, then what she should have done is she should have held him in contempt. She should have said, look it. He's supposed to answer my case, and he needs to recuse himself from this case, and he needs to answer my case. But if she sat there and she let a month go by, then the statute was done. She didn't appeal it. She didn't file anything within a month, so he came back because she didn't know what to do. Look at these judges. If you don't know what to do, they won't do anything, and they'll let the time run out, and then once the time run out, Then they hit you once they figure out what they're going
to
do.
Yeah, but there has to be, you have to figure out what the consequences. You know, look at if he, you know, we're looking at this potentially not so much as a contempt, but as a default, and as a potential default in something. Again, what was it that he was being drawn in for, and the detail of and what are the consequences that were written in for a default? In other words, you win something, you know, in the wherefore clause. This is what
she never filed a default, though. She should have filed a default.
But there were never any court. There were never any scheduled court dates for the lawsuit notice yet. I mean, he was served.
Was he served? Right.
He was.
So.
And he's got 60 days to answer. No, well, 30 days, actually.
Right, and that's my point. The fact is he was served, and then when he didn't answer, which obviously he didn't answer because they would have had a date, then it was up to her to file a default. And when that default didn't come, he knew she didn't know what she was doing.
When did the default take place?
Well,
late June.
Yeah,
okay,
so we're
close, aren't we?
Wait a minute.
Well, so, I don't know about that civil law lawsuit, and I know that the person who appeared with her in court on Friday when they hauled her off to jail, he was the actual person who served Judge Manley. So number one, she wasn't aware of the protective order. Number two, he was the defendant, and the plaintiff was he was presiding over a case. And number three, I have a copy of a federal court document from the U.S. District Court that said they remanded it back to Alameda County, not Santa Clara County. He is the judge in Santa Clara would not let it go. And if you look up Judge Manley, M-A-N-L-E-Y, he's very famous on the internet for getting people to take, he's like a pharmaceutical drug pusher. He gets people to take drugs in lieu of going to jail. So if he did think Tanya had a psychological or mental issue, sending her to a correctional facility with murderers and real criminals, I don't think that is a good place for somebody who has mentally or psychologically ill. Why wouldn't he send her to a health facility? So his actions, his decision to send her to jail for 3 weeks clearly is retaliation for, you know, her naming him as a defendant in a lawsuit, and it wasn't within their jurisdiction, and there's no proof of service that that she ever received a copy of that restraining order. So right now I'm trying to get her out of jail, and
okay,
I don't know, you know.
She's in jail for contempt. That's the only thing she could be in for. He ordered her to go for a psychological evaluation, and she didn't go. What else could he put her in jail for? He can't put her in jail for anything else but contempt.
He didn't put her in jail for contempt. I think he's putting her in jail for violating that original charge of violating the protective order. First, it was a misdemeanor, and then they bumped it up to a felony because when she was put initially, when she went to the school to see her daughter for a few minutes, the principal chased her off the property. She went straight to the police department to complain about the principal. They put her in ankle shackles and handcuffs, and I had to bail her out of jail. And at first, the bail bondsman said, "Connie, it's $900 to get her out." And then he called me later, and he says, "Nope, the judge bumped it up to a felony. It's $15,000." So I had to give him another $1,000 after the $500 to get her out of jail a year ago. But this case should have been argued on the point that she never, and she tried to argue it, but I don't think she did a very good job. She was representing herself. You know, literally when she went through this nasty divorce, they were bringing her from riches to rags. You know what I mean? You know, because they owned her and her
husband. He probably ruled on her case already, in other words. In other words, he dismissed her case and then ruled on it and sentenced her to jail. Basically,
but in the a friend of hers is going to try to get the transcript. He clearly said he wanted her to take psychiatric medications, and she said, "No, I will not. I do not have a psychiatric illness. I will not. I refuse." And then he said, "I want you to have a public defender. Will you have a public defender?" She says, "No, I refuse." He goes, "Then you're going to jail for 3 weeks." So, if that's in the transcript, he's punishing her for not taking psych meds.
That's contempt. That's all that is. That's not a sentence for her violation of her
original
thing.
Yeah, but he can't. I think we all agree that he can't force her to take psych meds.
Absolutely not. And he can't put her to jail for not doing it. But this guy's lawless, obviously. Did she serve him with the suit against him? The guy that served him, how long ago was that?
But it was, in June, maybe the first or second week of June. I can find out through a friend who served.
Well, it doesn't matter. So June, in the second or third week of July, is defaulted. He only gets 30 days to answer. He doesn't get 60 days. He's a defendant. And he doesn't have any judge privileges of 60 days. So when she served him and he didn't answer in 30 days, she should have filed a default paper. When she didn't do that, he knew she didn't know what she was doing. And then he stepped back. He stayed away for a couple of hearings because he didn't have the shuzzputs to show up. He knew that with her suing him, he couldn't show up. And he waited till the month was up, and then he reengaged because now that thing was done. It was, you know what I mean? She didn't, her case done because she didn't default him.
But how long did she have to default him? Isn't there a time period?
No, 30 days.
So if he doesn't respond in 30 days, she should have filed a default.
She should have filed a default right
away.
And
she could still file a default.
Well, she should, because that'll upset him. He doesn't think she knows that. So, you know, look, we're not giving legal
advice. But
we've
got to know what the consequences of that default is. You know, I don't know what's in the papers to say what the consequences.
Do you have to put them in the lawsuit?
Well, look at if it's default, what does that mean? What's the consequence? He agrees, and what does he agree to? And is there some kind of a penalty for that? You see, again, usually in the wherefore clause, you have to have a good wherefore clause and make sure you cover all these issues. You know, what are you expecting to get out of this? What do you expect to get out? When they default, you won.
She gets her wherefore clause, whatever it was.
Yeah, but again, and I'm sure there were other people. Well, again, I don't know exactly what the case was all about in the sense that, you know, other parties involved, what exactly was said in the paperwork. Was there a wherefore clause? You know, the filing of papers, does she understand, you know, the fundamentals of the paperwork to file a complaint or an action or whatever you want to call it?
And she had people in California, Bill and Aubrey, who were supposed to be well-versed in common law, who were coaching her and having them file all these papers. She was relying heavily on their knowledge.
Very careful, because again, You don't want to, if you don't understand, if people don't understand what's going on, they shouldn't do it. And that means you've got to get educated. And if you wait too long to get educated, you find yourself into a situation, well, shame on us if we didn't get educated beforehand if you had the opportunity. And because you don't wait to get in trouble before you get educated. And again, this is your responsibility to be able to understand and exercise your true liberties, to even understand what they are and what your rights are. But again, I don't know what.
I think one of the reasons why Judge Manley was served was because he ordered a psychiatric examination from her, or ordered it. But before he court-ordered it, he said in court, he thinks she needs to take psych meds, and he thinks she has a psychiatric illness. So I think, verified, I think her argument was the judge is trying to be a medical person. Who's
right, he's making a decision outside of his expertise. He's making a he's practicing medicine without a license. Basically.
Well, there you go. That is true, isn't it?
Right, and they're doing this to more and more people, whether they get some type of criminal charge.
Yeah, this is not new to us. This is not new.
Yeah. But I'm trying to get Tanya out of jail. So do you think requesting a jurisdiction hearing, somebody said if she requests one, they can refuse it. And she should ask for a public defender. And I think he should argue the point, number one, she wasn't aware of the protective order. Number two, Judge Manley.
Well, she should definitely take on a public defender at least to deal with the issue of her being in jail. Then she can always get rid of him once she's out of jail. She's got a right to get counsel if she wants and not to get counsel if she doesn't want.
Look, and he gave her 3 weeks.
And these other individuals, I don't know who they were. I don't know what they convinced her to say, but there's a lot of wacky stuff going on out there. And also, even there's a lot of stuff, even though it's true, the strategy they're using to deal with it is not the right strategy. And depending on the level of the judge, is the more, the judge may really think she's wacky, crazy, because he's not familiar with the stuff that she's bringing up, possibly. On a federal level, they know. I'm convinced that all federal judges understand clearly what's going on. They know that they're doing the wrong thing. They know that they're breaking the law, that they're subverting the Constitution. They know these things.
Well, this is a superior court judge, and he's clearly a drug pusher. And if you look him up on the internet, it's like, he lets people take drugs instead of going to jail. I mean, it's all over the internet. A lot of articles. They're like praising them for getting people. Now, I know a lot about drugs because I worked for Pfizer for 10 years. I worked for the FDA for 8.5. I know a lot about those antipsychotic drugs, and they are very dangerous and harmful.
Yes, boys.
Well, listen, he said she's going to jail for 3 weeks. So he put her in jail because it's contempt. She didn't do what he asked her. And there's two kinds of contempt. They can put you in there until you promise to perform the action he wanted to, or he could have just given her 3 weeks for being disorderly or whatever. So you have to figure out what the charge is. I mean, if it's 3 weeks, by the time she gets a public defender and all that stuff, she'll be out. But when the 3 weeks are up, he could say, okay, are you going to go take them drugs? You're going to go get that evaluation? And she says, no. He could say, I put you back in for 3 weeks. That can happen.
But is clearly a violation of some type of right.
No, it's not. It depends on if he said 3 weeks. Usually, if they're going to hold you in until you perform, they don't say 3 weeks. They just say, you're going to jail until you agree to do this. They don't put a time on it, right? Because you could say the next day, you could say, okay, I'll take the thing, and he has to let you out. So if he said 3 weeks, basically what he's doing is punishing her, and usually that doesn't happen unless you were disorderly in court. So he really doesn't have grounds for disorderly conduct. He has grounds for her disobeying an order of his, and I don't even know that it was an order or a suggestion. You can argue that whole thing, and he can't force her to take drugs or even go to a psychiatric evaluation.
Also, she's been denied her due process.
absolutely.
Okay.
Look at Lydia.
And if
Lydia
you denied your due process, then you're in a nisi prius court. And again, that'll be another position that they might think would be crazy because nisi prius courts don't have the power to fine or incarcerate. But the key thing here is this, is she challenged the court, well, not the court, she challenged the, I guess it's a prosecutor, with the fact that, wait a second, you have no proof I've ever been served? And there should be some document showing that they've been served. She's innocent until proven guilty, so they have to prove that she's been served in order for her to be guilty because when it comes to a criminal situation, an act, it's all about intent. It's all about state of mind, your intent. And if she had no intent, because she had no knowledge, she had no intent of breaking the law, there was no law broken. And to move this from a, you know, from a misdemeanor to a felony, I mean, come on, and still with no proof? Look at due process, I would immediately move this into federal court. That's what I would do. And
okay.
You move it into federal court for cause and get a hearing right away.
If she tried once to move it into federal court but didn't satisfy the two criteria, can she try again?
Because she didn't know. No, she could try it 10,000 times. Look at, but, you know, at some point they're going to, you know, try to sanction her. She's not a lawyer, so they really can't, but they'll do it anyway. But look, here's the thing, okay? Going into federal court is a word game, okay? It's for cause, C-A-U-S-E, which means exactly what it means. You're moving it for a cause. What is the cause of action? What is causing you to go into that court? Well, the fact that you're being denied due process, okay? You challenged, what due process were you denied? Well, look at, you know, she challenged the prosecutor saying, where is the pudding? I don't see the proof. Where is the pudding? I knew nothing about this, so I'm telling you I never received nothing. You can't hold me accountable when there is no intent of a crime. Crime requires intent. You know, you can have an accident, and it could be intentional or it could be an accident, but you have to prove that there was intent there. And if there was no intent there, you can't get someone for a crime. And if they have no proof of her receiving this information, then they have no case because she is innocent until they prove guilty. That's due cause. She's being denied her due process. And that is what the due cause is all about. You got to stay right on that point. And again, you know, I'll get back to this. People want to be ignorant and they want to be free. You can't have both. You're going to get beat up by the system if you get stuck in the system. If you do something a little outside of things and someone thinks you broke the law and they pull you into court, you're going to be railroaded. You're going to go to jail. You're going to be beat up because you don't know what to do. And if you go get a lawyer, then it's going to cost you a lot of money and you might get out paying a lot of money. I don't know. The whole thing stinks. Look, you get right back to education. If you don't know how to write a paper, then you can't get into court or protect or defend yourself in a court. If you don't know how to move a case from one place to another, and this is all simple stuff. This is not science. You know, what would you call it? Rocket science. Okay, this is all simple stuff. The only problem is this information on how to do these things have never been available to the people. Now it is available to the people. There's a guy that did a course. It's Jurisdictionary. As a matter of fact, you can buy it right off of our website. We didn't write it, but this guy did, and we took the course. That's how we learned how to access the courts. And it costs, no matter where you go, your court's the same. So if you buy it through our website, of course, we get a donation. I think it's $50 for each one that we bring to him for a sale. Once they get to sale. But the bottom line is this course is very, very good for given the breakdown. It's got some problems, you know, so you have to kind of get some further education. You get that from listening and participating with National Liberty Alliance here in these conversations or taking our courses. Also, the book and the next course that we're putting together will cover all this stuff, you know, how to access the court and on a state level, how to move it for cause into the federal, you know, and it's very simple. These are forms. You just follow the form, put in the details, the facts of your case, and you just move it to the system. The other thing is this, a lot of these groups that teach this stuff you know, the common law stuff. They really don't have the experience, and they put a lot of stuff in there that's not necessary. You want to kind of look as much as a lawyer as possible. Whatever you can follow the rules, follow the rules. As long as they're not repugnant, follow them. Understand the forms and how things are put up. What is the criteria? How to write a good wherefore clause. If you're going to write a whole case and win, but if you didn't ask for anything at the end, what did you win? You won nothing. You didn't give a wherefore clause. You know, all these things are important.
If you know somebody in California who can help get rid of that charges and get Tanya out of jail and out of this mess, you know, I have funds and you know, to pay. And so we don't trust lawyers.
Well, just bear in mind, look at we don't sell anything per se. We ask for donations. We do try to help people wherever we can. We were doing habeas corpuses, and we're asking for a donation of $100 or more for habeas corpus, and we had people that were, you know, filing them. We also made the point that if people didn't have money, $100, we'd still do it for them because we're not charging anybody for anything. And maybe they can afford to give us $5. That's fine. Or a dollar, whatever they want. Doesn't matter. We didn't turn anyone down when we were doing them. But if people had the money, you know, most people did pay. They put the $100. And again, it wasn't paying. It was a donation. Because this takes time, energy. You know, it takes a lot of my time. I was involved in putting it together, of course, and working with others. But, you know, I was always there spending my time and other people spending their time. Everybody's volunteering, but it still takes a lot of time. And then, of course, there's a filing process that we have to do for them. So there's maybe we have to file with maybe three different individuals, possibly, depending. I think usually it's about three or four individuals. And then we'd have to do the follow-up, and we'd have to give a ruling. And each one of these have to be certified. So there's cost involved in this. You know, there's toner, there's paper, there's the mailing and the certifying and so on. So, again, we've got two habeas corpuses that kind of got stuck somewhere, and we never kind of finished up on them. So we're trying to get that finished. But again, to take on the habeas, we don't have enough volunteers to work with us, with someone with the knowledge of how habeas corpuses works and how the system works, and, you know, so they understand the lingo and make sure that the paperwork is solid. And therefore, I have to spend my time to make sure that the paperwork is solid. And I'm just way, way too busy to put time into it. So it puts me into a situation. But, you know, I don't know. We'll see if we can help you. Give a call to Jim, and Jim, you can talk to me about this case, and we'll see if we can help you. Can someone unmute Jim? Go ahead.
Yeah, you were talking. A few days, one or two days ago, desperately asking for help. Her father wants her out. She wants out. I want to get her out. And we want, you know, this case could be really, if you look at the facts, again, she wasn't aware of that protective order. Now they're throwing in all the psych drugs. Oh, she's got a mental issue. You know, they're putting her through the ringer because her and her ex-husband owned a multi-million dollar company that makes robotic parts using robotic heart surgery. Their clients were like Intuitive Surgical, Lockheed Martin, and Northrop Grumman, you know, these big government contractors and stuff. And so
all right, I'll tell you what we'll do. You know, look, get all the paperwork together so we understand what's going on here. We need to understand both sides, what's going on. If there's transcripts or someone did affidavits of what took place in the court or something, of recording, okay, paperwork that were filed, orders. You know, we need everything that's on the docket. And if you can get everything on the docket, if it's not too involved, I'll take a look at it and I'll talk with Jim and see if we can't do a habeas corpus. Now, we're not always successful with habeas corpuses because these people, they don't care about nothing.
So do I call a specific person and what number?
Well, yeah, get a hold of Jen. Let me see.
Okay.
Hang on
yesterday.
A second. Terry, Jen just not happens not to be here tonight, or is he?
Yeah, Jen was traveling. Jan was traveling, and he didn't know whether he would end up here in time tonight. he was going to try if he found a place. I've got Jen. Did you want to talk to Jim in New York?
Well, I'll have her send the stuff directly. Well, when's Jan due back?
Sometime tonight is what I got.
Oh, okay. So she should try to get a hold of Jan and get him all of the information, or Jim, and get him all the information that I just asked for. If anything's missing, then we're going to screw this case up. We need to see it all.
Okay.
And Jim, unmute Jim, and Jim, maybe if you want to give your phone number to her, Jim, or your email to make the first connection, and you could exchange phone numbers. I think, doesn't Jim have a National Liberty Alliance email?
I've given out my number many times on different conference calls because I help people detox from Anna, so if you want, I'll give you...
Yeah, but I want you to connect with Jim. I don't know, is Jim hearing us? Is he here? And I also see that Brent's here now, so maybe, I don't know if we can move over to Brent in a short while.
And Tanya tried to contact Brent, too, yeah, before
right.
This happened. Yeah.
All right, I'm looking for... maybe Jim's gone.
Well, yeah, Jim's gone. I had him unmuted, and he didn't say anything, and then he left.
Okay. All right, call Jan tomorrow tell him he can come to the 1 hour and the 1 hour mark and actually a little before that and hear this conversation. And well, 1 hour mark should be good because it's 12 minutes after now. So, and just get him all the paperwork. You'll find his number up on the director's page. Let's see, it's his directory, and he's the national leader. Let's see, go to directory, click on directory. I think you go right to that page. Yep, you click on directory, and you go right to the page. You'll see the national coordinator. Jan is the 814 number. So call him up tomorrow and make a connection with him, and let's see what we can do. I'll see if we could do something.
Okay, thanks. And I'm sure a lot of them will bother me, and Tanya will all make...
How long has she been in jail for now?
Since Friday. Friday, they brought her straight from the courthouse to the Santa Clara County Jail, and then they moved her to Elmwood, I think, Friday night or Saturday morning.
All right, we need everything on the docket, everything.
Oh, okay. We've got a guy in California who was in court with her is trying to get it.
Okay. All right, let's move on. We'll talk to you. Maybe give us a call next week if you want. We can talk some more, but get a hold of Jan, and we'll try to get this going and see what we can do.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Gerard, do you want to move over to Brent, or do you want to take this one caller first? Well, let's take this caller.
Yeah,
Cliff,
that's what I was going to say.
And then we'll go over to Brent.
Okay, I'm going to unmute you, Cliff. Go ahead, you're unmuted, Cliff.
Thank you, guys. This goes out to both Gerard, John, and Brent, if he's available.
Yeah, Brent,
my question to you three is: has anyone ever taken Social Security Administration to court for being biased against a filer for supplemental income or disability that you guys are aware of?
Say this again, taking who to Social Security to court, you're saying?
Yes.
For?
Being biased or, you know, not, you know.
I've been thinking of suing Social Security because, you know, I put a lot of time years ago into Social Security, but the last 20 years or so I hadn't put anything into it. But nevertheless, there was a different kind of a contract back then, not only on the amounts of monies or percentage, because things change, there's the inflation and so on and so forth. But just different things. And it was a whole different plan, and things have changed. And I've been thinking about suing them. I just don't have the time to sue him. You know, that's the other problem. The other thing, which is a common problem and I'm thinking of doing, is suing the federal government for getting involved with our medical concerns. For instance, maybe drug testing you while you're on some kind of a painkiller, okay, and having you thrown off maybe if you use a little marijuana or something for pain, or just kicking you off of a painkiller because we don't want to give it to you no more. Wait a second, you're treating someone for pain. You know, you can't presume that they're abusing it. But any good medical doctor that's paying attention to their patient should be able to know whether they're abusing and the drug or not. They should be able to figure that out. But in any event, federal government steps in and they give a problem. So they're a problem everywhere. But what do you have in mind with the Social Security?
Well, I've been filing since 2016 for either supplemental income or disability. And every time I've tried, I've always gotten a letter back from Social Security saying that, one, I don't have enough work credits or I didn't pay into Social Security enough, or two, I don't have enough medical history. And every time I've been filing under stress, anxiety, and depression.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
I even went to my doctor and asked her, and she's not really a doctor. She has somebody that she's supervised under, and she can't really prescribe medication. And she's asked me to go to Alpena ER. I went to them. Alpena ER has turned
well,
me down.
Well, before getting
into
any, too many, before getting into too many details, a couple of things. It does take a while, especially if you're not filing for regular Social Security, and you're looking into filing for the disability side of things, and it's a little different and it takes longer. I filed for my daughter, and we filed in 2016, and she still hasn't gotten it. We've gotten numerous, papers saying that she doesn't qualify. I mean, it's the most absurd thing in the world because my daughter has a very serious heart condition. But in any event, they denied. And I'm in the middle of arguing. There's one denial coming through the thing, going back with it, and they get another letter saying that she's been accepted for this or come in for another interview. I mean, they can't even make their mind up on what they're doing. But I have always heard, especially if you're coming in from the standpoint of trying to get a disability thing going, that it doesn't matter how good your case is, they'll reject you, okay? And believe me, I got them on the law. Hands down, record, my daughter's been under, she's 22 now, but she's been under medical care of a heart condition since she was a baby, okay, and had surgery, heart surgery, and many other things involved in this particular case. I mean, it's just total absurdity. This is what they do. So you have to keep fighting, and you have to keep throwing the law at them. You have to keep laying out your position to them and keep moving and escalating, constantly appeal. It's part of what they do.
Mm-hmm.
But once you do get through...
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, and once you get through this system, though, one of the things I understand is that, you get paid, or should get paid, from the moment that, from the day that she first filed, as long as that case gets active, appealing processes and so on and so forth, if you go for 2 years, they're going to pay you for 24 months all in one shot. So that's quite a bit of money,
mm-hmm.
And then you
right.
get your money
and
income.
I mean, with me, John, that's all cool and stuff like that. It's not, it's not about the money principle. I mean, yeah, I know I'm going to, I know if I win the thing that I'm going to get it and stuff like this, and I'll be, financially set, you know, comes to mind. But the thing that I went to an appeals court twice, once face to face with the judge, and secondly over the phone because, well, we ran out of gas and I couldn't get to the appointment, so they allowed me to do it over the phone. The first time in front of an actual judge in their kangaroo court system, if you want to call it that.
It's really more of an arbitrator. He's not a judge, and it's administrative. It's a process, and it's just an appeal process.
Yeah. Well, I found out the first one that I was at a 50-50. Would I get it or would I not? When the judge found out some stuff about me and stuff like this, she denied me right then and there, and she said that I am not going to award you because of what I found out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like, you know, talking about my past, and, you know, unless, you know, you bring it up and ask me about my past, then I'm compelled to tell you. Other than that, I don't like bringing it up. And then the
second time, you know, how many, do you have another appeal? You can appeal that, or has it come to an end?
No, right now I'm at I have a law firm. It's called Citizens Disability.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever heard of them or not.
Yeah, there's all kinds of different firms out there that'll work off of a percentage, you know, usually a third, because they figure, well, if you're going to go and they can get you the money, if they can get you on and you've got 2 years behind you, you know, they'll calculate the amount of money and work a third, and they'll take the case on. Matter of fact, I think they have to take the case on. And then what happens, bear in mind, part of this problem, I think, is the fact that they want to hold your money up so you do go get a lawyer, and the lawyers make some money on this thing. And so in order to make it worthwhile for the lawyer, you know, maybe they hold it over for 2 years. I mean, that's my opinion. Looking the way they operate everything else is nothing but a money game. Everything they're doing, it's a money thing. It's a cash register thing. So I wouldn't doubt that that's part of the game.
It pretty much goes in with the old famous saying, money talks and BS walks.
Right. And people who have gone 2 years and stuff, finally they get word about a lawyer and they say, well, let me go get a lawyer. And any lawyer will jump on that quick. And maybe they can get it done quickly because you've gone through enough time for the lawyer to make the money. And that's the thing. And I do believe that that is the case. You know, all this stuff is about money, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But,
I
would suggest trying these people. Remember this one thing. Hold on. Remember this one thing.
Mm-hmm.
This lawyers that you would get, remember, they're going to fight your battle on the administrative process, the law, the code, whatever you want to call it, the statutes that they have there. It's all administrative. But it's my opinion, from what I know of all this stuff, that it's good stuff. It's
mm-hmm.
not damaged. It's not hurting. Why not go in on the statutory side of things? Because it is a statutory thing anyway. And and Social Security or disability wasn't around, you know, 100 years ago. So, I mean, it's a good system, in my opinion. Okay, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It's very fair-minded. And again, the people may not be fair-minded, and again, they may be doing this just for two reasons. Number one, maybe you'll just go away. Yeah, fine, that's part of their strategy. Number two, they'll keep pushing your way long enough that you have enough time in for a lawyer to come in and get involved and make a buck out of this thing. And again, it's just feeding the minions, you know? So.
Well, what I was going to say, John, was is that I've got a friend of mine that is a NLA, and he was right there when he heard it. I told Citizens Disability that I said, if you guys can just get it for me, I said, I guarantee you, as God is my witness, you'll get you'll get the whole. I said, you'll get the whole thing.
Yeah,
I said,
you
it's
will.
Not about.
I'm sure
about the
you
money.
Probably
it's not
will.
Not about anything. It's the principle.
Let me tell you how incompetent. Let me tell you how incompetent these people are. The last paper that I got of a rejection said that my daughter is being rejected because her illness began after she turned 21, okay, and not before. I mean, that was there's no more. I sent
that's
them
crap.
2 inches, a 2 inch thick, literally a 2 inches of thick papers, okay, of her file, okay, that I mailed into them. So that they could see and, you know, go back. They got contact, of course, with a cardiologist and numerous other doctors. And yet their decision was she was not qualified because the illness began after she was 21. So go figure that out. That it just, it's beyond belief. How can they look into this file?
I agree. And
so that's,
you know,
what you're going through.
I don't
There's
know
a
if
lot of incompetence,
John, but my heart goes out to you, man, and your daughter is in my prayers.
I appreciate that. But anyway, this is the way they play the game, and you're right. If you get a lawyer and you're willing to give up the money, you'll get it. If you educate yourself and you think you can handle it, you can win it on your own. But you better know their law. You know, look at, you got, I read some of the stuff on the, and I don't have a problem with it. I told you before, this is good stuff. It benefits the people. And, And most people do get on to this thing. But you have to know the game. You have to know the law. And you have to put it in front of them and say, this is the code. This is the what you have to follow. You can't go outside this.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you feel confident you could do that, fine. But if not, you know, get a lawyer involved, and their expertise in those areas, they'll get it for you.
Right, and that's why I was wondering if, you know, besides you, if Gerard or Brent, which I think are two of the coolest, besides you, I think all of you guys are cool at NLA, but I'll tell you what, Brent's knowledge and Gerard's knowledge on things, Brent goes about it in a little bit of a comical way. Gerard writes straight to the point. And I guarantee you, if you want to be hit with the truth and you're ready to handle it, watch out. But anyway, yeah, I was wondering if them two, you know, ever ran into any of the same situations. And, you know,
well, I'll see if they
want
to
getting ready to play the game.
Yeah, let's see if they want to comment on that. If they can, they can unmute themselves and comment in a minute. I just want to make one other statement you know, the in law there are, what is it? I think it's 51, maybe 52 different uniform codes, okay? The USC 1, USC 2, USC 3, all the way up to 51 or 52. And I think it's 52, and I think number 51 is reserved, so there's really no code under 51, or maybe it's 50, but one of those there. All of this is lawful law. Okay, even
mm-hmm.
U.S. 26 could be considered lawful law. Okay, the problem is there's way too much repugnancy in that one, way, way too much. But and stupidity, and I read that stuff, and I wonder if I'm even reading English. I mean, I just, are they saying what I think they're saying? It just doesn't even make sense. That's how bad 26 is, USC 26, and now U.S. USC 18 and USC 42, okay? When it gets into the penal code under US 18, USC 18, I think this is where the penal code is, when it gets into that and talks about our behavior and different things, you see all that is repugnant, okay? When the federal government thinks that they have some kind of a monopoly of some kind on the law, on a federal law on the one end, where they haven't been given authority. For instance, let's take marijuana. If you go to a federal hospital, if you're a vet and you go to the VA hospital, it's federal controlled. And if they check your blood and they find that you're taking, for instance, marijuana, and they're checking your blood maybe because you're under pain management, They think that they have the power and the authority because they think it's against the law. They think that they have the power to make that law and make it against the law for you to take that kind of a thing. But they don't. They have that power in the code, but they don't have the power in the Constitution to write that code. See, so that's my point. So when you get into 18 and you get into 42, there's a lot of great stuff in there that we can use, and it's powerful. But when it comes to controlling our behavior, particularly in U.S. 18, okay, well, they don't have that power and authority, and you have to have the ability to see, wait, that's repugnant to the Constitution, Marbury versus Madison. That's repugnant to the Constitution. So that can't hold, so you can make your argument. So my point is this. All these USCs, all these U.S. codes, okay, as long as when you look into them, there's nothing there that's repugnant to the Constitution, it's lawful, because we have given them the authority to write those codes from Title I all the way through Title 52. And again, I think there's 51 or 52 titles. But they have the right to write this.
No, I believe
they have the authority to write it. But they don't have the authority to step beyond their authority, nor do they have the authority to write where they have no authority at all to even control your behavior. They can't control the people's behavior, and you'll find that under U.S. 18. And that's why even more now than ever, you know, jury nullification is extremely important, and people need to understand that, and our juries need to exercise that, and they need to be orientated in that knowledge prior to sitting down and hearing a case for them to judge as the judges of a case. So the reason I'm saying this again is to make the point that you can have this lawyer battle you under the codes that they write. And again, I've read quite a bit of it, not all of it, but I've read some of it, and I'm good with it, and it's good stuff. You'll win. A lawyer can win this case.
Oh, yeah.
The only problem is they're going to take a third of your money.
Yeah, that's fine. They could take the whole thing, and I'll still take them out to dinner. I mean, that's just the way my character is.
Well, don't let them know
is,
that,
you know?
Because they'll take the whole thing and expect their dinner at the same time. It'll be all right, anyway, Gerard or Brent, do you want to comment on this, Gerard or Brent?
Gerard, you can go ahead, and I can comment when John asks me.
Yeah, I don't really know anything about the SSI. I know some of the law because I've had people close to me that went on, and I have read their code and watched some of their tactics. But I don't have any special insights to it or anything like that. You know, so I can't tell you any more than what you just told him. You know, and as far as my experience, so I don't have a lot of experience on that other than, you know, reading. I mean, everybody that I dealt with, they got on it. You know what I mean? It wasn't a problem. It was just, you know, what do you call it? Just in the little details back and forth. So I really, you know, nothing I've done ever really helped anybody as far as, like you said, where they were being discriminatory. I do know that they have a habit of refusing you. You know, there's a certain minimum time that I see the same pattern all the time, and usually from the time you put it in to the time you get it, from what I see, it takes about 3 years, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah,
I see it usually taking a couple of years if you're going for the disability side of things, yeah.
Right, but sometimes it goes very fast. And the one thing that makes it go very fast is when you're in a hospital and you do have that medical background, the doctor's pulling for you or whatever, and the one thing they move real fast on is if they say that you got a mental problem, they don't have any problem putting you on disability for a perceived mental problem. Even if you don't have it, if you just claim to have it, boy, right away they oh, yeah, you're disabled.
Oh, yeah.
Boom, boom. They throw you right in that system, which I don't suggest doing because now you're marked for life. You know what I mean? And so
I definitely understand what you're saying, Gerard, because I went, you know, for the, you know, therapy and stuff like that, which was requested by my doctor. I was seeing a therapist for, like, I think it was maybe 3 weeks. On the third week, I know that I was seeing this person. This person said, basically, and I wish to God I would have had something to, you know, to record it. But she basically said to me, this was her exact words, "I'm sorry, Mr. Geiger, but we cannot help you. It's my determination that you are making all of this up for negative or positive attention. We're going to end all of the sessions that were scheduled. And if you have some, like, real emergency, my advice to you would be call 911 and then let 911 basically deal with it." And I thought, oh, well, great. Now I've got Munchausen's disease by proxy.
Yeah.
You know, and so, I mean, yeah, I laughed about it, too, because that really showed me, you know, the psychology aspect of this is, I guess, an absolute joke with them. Unless, you know, you're suicidal and, you know, trying to figure out if there's a way that you can cut yourself with a butter knife, you know, yeah, then they'll get involved. But, yeah, so that's what happened with me. And, you know, that's why, you know, I've listened to you a lot, Gerard, and I'm telling you, you know how to hit a person with the truth. And Brent, he's got the, you know, the humorous side about it, but he also hits you with the truth, too. And that's why with the stuff that I'm going through, and I am fighting this tooth and nail as best as I can. That's why I asked, you know, you three, if you guys have ever in your life heard of anyone going to an actual court outside of their makeshift kangaroo court.
Well, yes, you can do that. You can do that, okay? Nothing's stopping you from doing that, but you have to have a case to do that. And so you have to develop that case. And, again, I don't think that you're going to have a problem in the long run, because this is what they do. They take a long time. But in any event, I want to move over to Brent. Do you have a final word? And then we'll see if Brent says that when he picks up the mic, he may comment on this also. But do you have a final word before we move over to Brent?
No, my final word is that, look, Brent is steeped very deeply in common law, and I defer to him on all that stuff because he's very good, and that's where you want to be. Anyway, go ahead, John.
Mm-hmm. Are you done? How about you, Cliff? Are you done? I'll move over to Brent.
I was going to ask you, what is that USC thing that you were saying, 1 through possible 52?
Yeah,
so I can write it down and look it up?
United States codes, okay? You can put up the United States codes, Title 1, Title 2. And once you just Google that, all of a sudden you'll see USC titles, and then and you click on that, and you'll see they'll list all of them up. And all the law is there. All of the statutes are there, okay? And you can go through that and see there's a lot of good stuff there. Look, we've given government the authority and the power to do certain things. The problem is they abuse their power, they abuse their authority, they abuse their jurisdiction, and this is the problem. That we have to tighten up on these people. And the only way we're going to tighten up on these people is we start doing our job. Our job is to consent to government, because we haven't been doing that. We haven't been doing it for over 100 years. We have not been consenting to government. Where, you know, they'll tell us you can consent by you go to the voting box. You know, that's where you consent. No. That's one of the places. But we got to get the choice to decide who these people are that's going to go on a ballot. That has to belong to the people. Right now, the people are not consenting because they've lost that. They've lost the knowledge of that authority that they have to control the political process. The same thing in the judicial process. And again, this is what National Liberty Alliance is here for, to teach you both of those sides of things. The other side, of course, is the mm-hmm. judicial process. We need to control that. We need to nullify that which is wrong. We need to take control of the grand juries and not allow them to dictate to us and violate the grand juries to the point of mind control and getting the required outcome. You know, they do psychologicals on people with these questions, and they set the people up for cases to get the required outcome. And so that's mm-hmm. this is two of the things that people need to do. They also need to understand the Constitution, understand the federal laws and how things are structured, and also local constitution and the basic laws. You don't have to get into the details of the laws that we're not going to be involved in, because, again, these laws, these authorities, we've given them the right statutes, are all on usually commercial things and different things, maybe, you know, bankruptcy law and different things, election law. All this stuff is important stuff, and we gave them the authority to do it, and they did it. And they did a reasonably good job on a lot of this stuff. But they stick yeah. all the garbage in here and there to control us, okay, which is null and void. It's repugnant. And so we have to be able to lay that out and say, wait a second, we didn't give them the authority to write this or to focus in on this. And this is repugnant to the Bill of Rights. You can't have this. You see, we have to educate the people to be able to do that so that they can nullify, okay? And
If it's safe for me to say, that first caller that you guys were talking to, when I found out that the judge is basically allowed to become a therapist and a drug pusher while on the bench, I looked at my friend and slash roommate, and I asked him. I said, "Who is the injured party?" And he just looked at me, shrugged his shoulders, and I said, "I'll tell you right now, it's the judge. The judge got his feelings hurt because this lady that's incarcerated for what? Hurting the judge's feelings or contempt or whatever it was that, you know, that you guys are unaware of. I think the judge got his feelings hurt, and that's why he, you know, decided that he was now going to become an executor."
She is the injured body.
Yeah, she is. So
right.
I mean, yeah, I understand exactly, you know, where you're coming from with all of this.
Okay,
and,
well, let me just finish
gonna,
up my
you know,
other
shut
point.
Shut my mouth
here.
And see what
let me finish up.
Brent,
let me finish up this
say.
Point. Yeah, let me finish up this point, and then move over to Brent because I'm just about done anyway. But the key thing is this, is people need to take the responsibility. They need to step up. They need to become educated. We're at a point in time we need George Washington's. We need Benjamin Franklin's. We need Jefferson's. You know, we need people to step up and do the necessary work now to take back our nation, our country again. And so that takes some time, and again, but the education that you need to do those things is the education you should have anyway. You need to be able to go into a court of law and handle your own case. It is, in my opinion, and I've thought about this, and I've thought about this every day for over 10 years since I've been involved in this. I always keep putting this litmus test, this question in me, since when is there a case? Where is there a case where people are a problem handling their own case? You know, they tell you that, oh, you should never represent yourself, you know, this, that, the other thing. Well, yeah, if you're going to go to the court of bullshit, you know, the court where you get all of this stuff here, you got this loophole and that loophole, and you got to have a lawyer who has the charisma to work through this stuff and the knowledge and to bring this into the court to get you off the hook for this or that. Well, anyway, that's not what a court of justice is about. Okay, but, you know, the best person that knows your case the best is you. And you need to be able to mm-hmm. understand the process, the procedure, and the necessary common law ideals, which is really, you know, really just common sense, okay, the law of the heart, and work that together and get the battle going in the courtroom, person to person, to deal with the problem. So the best person to handle your case is you, okay? Now, and I believe
I understand.
Okay, and so that's what people need to do. Now, there's nothing wrong with getting counseling, and counseling doesn't mean a bar attorney. Counseling means whoever you want, you know, to give you you know ideas. So there's nothing wrong with getting someone who's fluent in a particular in the law in a certain way that can benefit you and work with you. But you should be handling your case, and battling it out. You can have someone articulate your case. If you're not a person who can articulate well, then so you have someone else mm-hmm. articulating your case, but you need to have strings on that person. Say, whoa, that's not the way it works. You know, it was or whatever. You know, you need to control your case. Lawyers don't let you do
right.
that. They want you to sit there like a lump on the log and let them handle everything. Just shut up and be still and get to the end. I'll make my money and maybe you'll go to jail, maybe you won't. But, you know, that's their attitude, in my opinion. All right, let me move over to Brent. He's going to give
John,
me some.
All that being said, I've been in court before, and some people are their own worst enemies. That's just a little caveat.
That could be good, and that's why that's
some people
why those,
should not talk in court. I'm telling you, but anyway.
Well, that's why those people might want to have someone to articulate it for them if they feel that they're that kind of person, mouth and foot disease thing, or whatever, or they just can't articulate well. Okay, so you have someone who can, but the bottom line is you got to have a rein on that person to make sure they get it straight. You're there. This is your case, not their case. You know, that's the key. Don't turn your case over to a lawyer and give them free go. Let me tell you, I had a lawyer recently stuck on the phone, and when I started looking into a case, well, I want this and I want that. I mean, I thought she was going to go into cardiac arrest, and, you know, just silence on the phone. Whoever asked for this stuff before? I want to look into the case. I want to see what kind of papers you wrote. How come you didn't show the client your papers? You wrote these things. You make them sign it. They don't know what's on it. And then you file it in the courts, you know, and then they don't get a copy, you know. That kind of thing. You need to know what's going on in your case.
Most of the cases in the Nisi Prius courts, in the town courts, there's a partnership, it seems to me, from what I see, between the judge, the attorney, the judge, and the prosecutor. They're working with each other.
Did you say Nisi Prius courts?
What's that?
Did you say Nisi Prius court?
No, I don't have any courts. Yes. There's no Nisi Prius court.
Nisi Prius, but it sounded like you said Nisi Prius courts. But go ahead.
But that's the problem, what you're talking about. When they get in a partnership and they don't inform you and they treat you like a piece of meat and they make money off of you. So,
yeah.
I mean, that happens. I know that happens. So, anyway,
be involved in your case. Be educated. Understand the forms. Read the papers. Know what the papers are saying. If you're not sure, you ask the questions and you make the correction. Say, no, that's not the way it happened. This is the way it went. You see, you got to be involved in your case. But lawyers, they do get a lot involved in strategies to try to get this thrown out and that thrown out and the other thing, all of the BS when it says, let's get to the case, you know? Anyway, let's move over to Brent. We've been trying to do that for quite some time now. Brent, are you on the mic?
Yes.
The mic? Okay,
yes.
If you want to answer or respond to that, you can in the beginning, but let me move over to Brent. Brent Winters is the author of The Excellence in the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic.
Thanks.
And Gerard,
John.
You've got the board, right? Gerard, you got the board, right? Where did Gerard go?
Yeah, I got the board.
Okay, thank you.
Just drink. Okay, now don't disturb me again.
All right. Ed, Brent.
Okay, thanks. Well, as to the SSI or Social Security case, the people that make the most money in America doing SSI cases are not lawyers. And it's an administrative jurisdiction, a federal jurisdiction. And in that jurisdiction, it's one of those places where you don't have to be a lawyer to practice in it. And there are non-lawyers that make exorbitant, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. They learn how it's done, and they got the procedure down pat, and I don't know any of them. I've read about it. I've known people who have gone to seminars to learn how to do these kind of cases for other people, and they're taught by people that are not lawyers. There are lawyers that do it, too, but the people that really do it are non-lawyers, and they're very good at it. But what I did learn with this one case, I couldn't get out of doing. I did one case. It took a long time, as John pointed out. It took a few years. I did learn, and I read a lot about it and talked to people. I learned that when you do an SSI case, this has been over 10 years ago, so I'm speaking from experience 10 years ago. Whatever carries forward, I imagine most of what I say does. But at that time, it was axiomatic. First time you go into Social Security court, you lose. And everybody that did it, that I talked to, that did it for a living, said, you lose first time. That's just understood. That's the way they do it. they make you come back twice. Lawyers learn the game, and they just know it's a matter of going through the motions. And by the way, the lawyer gets, by law, his fee is capped. The federal government caps it. At that time, I believe it was, I'm pretty sure I got this right, 25% of whatever the take is. In other words, by the time you, the longer it drags out, you see, the more money they owe, the Social Security owes if you win. Well, that inures to the benefit of the lawyer. The client just has to wait for his money. But if the case drags out and you have to file it once, then file it twice, that's all part of the machinery to ensure that the, not the lawyer, but the counsel. He couldn't be a lawyer. A lot of times he isn't. He makes a lot of money because of the way the bureaucratic administrative law system is set up. It's set up to benefit the lawyer. But they do cap his take at 25%. That's one of the things I've learned. I believe that's all I wanted to mention about, oh, there was one other thing. I would advise you, if you're going to go in there and ask for a, not advise you, I'm not your lawyer, but I would, a friend to friend here on the telephone, I would say if you were going to do it, you'd stand the best chance if you had a lawyer. What's the reason for that? Well, one of the biggest reasons is, as I said a while ago, the whole administrative bureaucratic system is the law of the city. It is the civil law. It follows those principles. There is no jury. The judge represents the government, and he's the judge at the same time. So that's the law of the city. One party to the litigation sets a judge in his own case. That's the way the federal system works. You're dealing with the court of the president of the United States. You're dealing with the executive branch, not the judicial branch. You're not dealing really with a court. You're just dealing with a bureaucrat. Not to say a lot of them are nice. This one fellow I was in front of in Indiana, he was blind, couldn't see a thing. He was a nice fellow. We knew some of the same people. We found out he got to ask me about myself. And then he said to me, well, tell me what the paper says that you filed. Well, he couldn't read it. His eyes didn't work. And so I read some of the pertinent parts. He asked me a few questions, and I told him what it said. But he was cocked and loaded, and these administrative courts, it's just like a machine. He had a registered nurse sitting on the side there who made a living doing nothing but evaluating every case that came up before the judge. And if the judge decided to rule against the applicant, then he would put the nurse on the witness stand to testify against the applicant to justify his denial. So if you go into administrative court like that, a SSI court, Social Security, and you've got somebody that knows the machinery and that the government wants to give money to, they want to give money to these people that represent people in Social Security court, then you stand a lot better chance. You say, well, that ain't right. Well, no, administrative courts are wrong all the way around, just like the tax court and the Social Security court. But if you go in and you really want to push it to the limit, make sure in an administrative court, in a federal administrative court like this one, you've got to make your case in the administrative court. You've got to get all of the evidence in, because if you appeal from there to a real court, whether of the judicial branch, with a guy with a black robe who was confirmed by the Senate of the United States, as our Constitution says, well, when you get there, you already got to have all your evidence in. That's not the way it's supposed to be either, in my humble opinion, but that's the way it works. So I'm not telling you the way it ought to be. I'm telling you the way it is. That doesn't make it right, but there it is for what it's worth. Well, so much for that. I hope you remember where we left off. I do want to get to the Constitution of the United States, because I talked about the preamble, and I was ready to plow right into the Article 1, but I wanted to say one other thing about the preamble. Our Constitution of the United States does not claim to secure liberty, but it claims to secure, now watch this word, the blessings of liberty. Blessings. Now, that word blessings is worth camping on for a moment. That's a very special word. And when the drafters of the Constitution of the United States put the preamble in here, it is intended to be key, this preamble, to the understanding of the, everything written within the four corners, as it were, of the document. This preamble is something that when people came across the ocean and they came through Ellis Island, they learned, some of them at some different times, I don't know if it's true today, but they had to memorize it in English. And the preamble of the Constitution of the United States, if they didn't know anything else, they had to know that. That was true at some points in our history. And so it bears memorizing. And if you care about our Constitution of the United States, I would admonish you, challenge you, to memorize the preamble to our Constitution. It's very possible if you do that, it would open up to you a whole lot of things. There's something about planting in mental sod words like that, because once you do that, then you begin to contemplate those words. When you're standing in line at the grocery store, you've got something worthwhile to think about. Your mind isn't racing. You're looking at the tabloids and the movie stars, the country music stars. You've got something substantive to go over in your mind that will enable you to contribute to others. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, just memorize it. And then after you memorize, think about it, but it's got that word in there, blessings. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility. And then it says, ensure the blessings of liberty. Blessings. Blessings is decidedly a Christian word. These folk that drafted the Constitution and the ones that ratified it, the people of the United States, they breathed an atmosphere of common law. We don't. We're getting this ignorant. It makes no difference how many college degrees you got. Probably the smartest man in Europe during the days of the Reformation was that well-known man named John Calvin, educated as a Roman lawyer at the preeminent school for Roman lawyers, lawyers of the Roman law, at Orleans in France, as his father before him. He was considered the best versed lawyer of the law of the city in Europe in his day. And John Calvin, because he lived on the continent of Europe for all of his learning, and Geneva became the city of Calvin, and it became the Rome of Protestantism for this reason. In other words, they were burning people at the stake in Geneva, doing the very things they were complaining that Rome was doing to the Protestants, and the reason it was happening because John Calvin could never come to grips. He didn't understand. He didn't breathe the air, the atmosphere of the common law. And so he tried to understand the Bible in terms of the Code of Justinian, the canon law of the church. He was a Roman priest at one time, and it didn't work. That's a lesson to us. We're losing this atmosphere of our common law. Our common law is not a list of laws. It's a way, W-A-Y, of life. And it catches hold of you more than you catch it. And once it has a hold of your mind, you see everything differently. It's not that we don't see eye to eye with men like John Calvin. It's that we're looking in opposite directions. I say that softly. I don't know a lot about Calvin, and his personality is something people fight about a lot. I read some of his other stuff. Very smart man, but he admitted, this is noteworthy, and later in his life, in his commentary on Seneca, he admitted that he couldn't put it together. He was studying the Bible, which, of course, undergirds our common law, and our common law undergirds the Bible. The laws of nature unwritten in the nature of things, and the laws of nature of God written in the Bible, as our Declaration of 76 puts it. And he couldn't square the Bible with his approach to law as a civilian. That's what lawyers in all of the world are called that are not common law countries. They're called civilians. He was the preeminent civilian of his day. The word civilian is a law of the city word, a Roman word. Well, all of that should say something to us. It's not a matter of taking a document like our Constitution and say, I'm going to learn the Constitution. That's it. That'll get it. No, it doesn't work that way. Our Constitution is a brief of common law government drafted by men who breathed in and out 24 hours a day, and they lived among a people that breathed in and out 24 hours a day the common law. They lived in a world where juries were just understood. That's who we are. And everybody understood what jury duty was. Everybody that was grown. Folk knew what a militia was. Every colony had them, and they were all being used in those early days. And the militia is we the people. And the militia has two duties. Duties to defend against enemies foreign. That's to be willing to take up arms. And the second duty of that pool of persons called the militia is jury duty. In other words, justice. Well, Blessings, a long way around the barn to get to this point. I got to talking about too many rabbit trails. But blessing, the word blessing is decidedly a Christian word. And the reason it's in here is because these people lived in a Christian world where Christian words were used. It was part of their life and understanding, even if for all of their different views, even those that denied any affiliation with the church were smart enough to know you don't offend people about the Bible. And blessing is one of those words. It's not a Latin word. It's an old Anglo-Saxon word, very old. And the word bless means to smear anointing. To smear blood on. Bless is an old Anglo-Dane word, an old Nordic word that means to smear blood on. And the object, it's a Christian thought because the Passover of Egypt, when the Israelites came out of Egypt, they were instructed by their God to take a lamb into their home the night before they were to get up and leave. The lamb became part of the family, and then they were instructed to kill it that night and eat it rapidly with their hat on, their shoes on, and their staff in their hands, ready to run. And to take the blood from the lamb or the little goat, the Hebrew word can apply to either, and we don't know for sure which one it was, but probably a lamb, a kid or a lamb. That's not the point of the story, the example that makes the difference. And they were to take hyssop, which is a plant that has kind of a fuzzy thing on the end, dip it in the blood, and strike the top of the doorpost of their humble tenement and the doorpost to the side. And the Lord himself said he would come over, and when he saw the blood, he would pass over that dwelling, and he would not kill the firstborn, because the Lord says, I will kill the firstborn of every Egyptian, from the man in the dungeon in the prison, his firstborn, or if he is a firstborn, clear up to the great God of Egypt, claimed to be the great God, Pharaoh himself, and of all the livestock in the field. But if you have struck the blood on the lintel of your doorpost and on the up above there, where we used to call it the transom, I will, really the word Passover is used. That word was invented by William Tyndale when he translated the Bible into English. I think it means a little more jump over, skip over. I'll skip your house. That's really what it means. I'll skip your house if I see the blood. Well, that word blessing came out of that understanding of the Bible. That's where that word came from. And it's in our Constitution of the United States because the folk that drafted it were, well, it was just part of their cachet of words. And blessing is also related to the old Anglo word, the same root as bliss. Because if you have that blessing from your maker, that's a happy thing, blissful. That means happy. So it's worth contemplating the history of words, because those words freight into their context often powerful meanings, and those meanings come from history. And the meaning they bring in comes from the stories we can learn about the use of the word, and blessing is one of those words, and those folk that drafted our declaration understood that. Well, that's just a minute, I have to pull something up here I want to look at, namely the some of the information I want to talk about. Well, that's our preamble. Our preamble says the general government's power. It is the general government in Washington, D.C. I think we should call it the general government. I do not believe we should call it the federal government. Our forebears called it the general government, and they called it the general government because they didn't believe it was the head. Federal means head. Back to words again here. And they didn't look at it that way. The name federal government became in vogue during the war between the northern and the southern tiers of the states. It is a general government because it does have authority to set down uniform general rules that apply to everybody. And within those wide boundaries of general rules, and there are general first principles, within that, the state governments can be more particular, less general about requirements. For example, a while ago, the subject was brought up about a lady that was in jail. She did not receive notice of a protective order. And if you don't receive notice, you're not obligated. That's all true. You have to due process, most fundamentally, at bottom, among many things, but it demands timely notice to the other party, timely to prepare a response, and then a meaningful, genuine opportunity to come to the place of battle named in the notice, battle by trial or battle before the judge, and make your case. And if you don't get notice, due process hasn't been followed. You, as Jesus Christ said in the Gospels, no, it wasn't him, he didn't say that, he suffered it. But in the book of Acts, when the Roman tribunals were constantly trying to jail people, you know, somebody said, when Paul the Apostle got to town, he never asked what the hotels were like. He always asked what the jails were like, because he knew that's where he'd wind up. That's not funny. They really hurt him in a lot of cases. But when he get to these places, these jails there, well, they get him to, they want to get people to jail. Sometimes they do things to Paul the Apostle. They would, one time, the Roman authorities did what you do in the law of the city. You torture people. And then most fundamentally, it comes down to, sometimes you just get a good beat because they want to beat some information out of you. That's just part and parcel of the way it's done in South America, for instance. Well, and the Nazi Germany, where else you want to go, Africa. Well, they did that to Paul the Apostle. It was nothing personal, you understand. That's just the way our law works. And one time they did that and threw him in jail, and he said, I think you fellows made it. They tried. Then they went to release him. And he said to them, I think you fellows made a mistake, to the guards. They said, what do you mean? He said, I'm a Roman citizen. Now, it was true in Rome, and this wasn't a bad thing. The law at that time said you weren't allowed to beat a man or jail him without an opportunity to be heard. Now, even when I was talking about Jesus Christ a while ago, when they tried him, the question was asked, isn't it our law that we're not to condemn a man before he's had an opportunity to be heard? So these things are important, and men everywhere know that due process is important. It's just that men everywhere haven't had the necessary gumption breath behind what they were doing to keep it going. We, in the English-speaking world, for whatever reason, by the providence of God, have enjoyed that. You see, the Romans, they'd put those systems in place. They knew what common law government was. You can go back and read the history of Rome, the founding of the city, and all that happened. And Well, they understood what they needed, but they couldn't keep it going. It wasn't possible. They didn't have the power. As Bagot said of the barrister from England of 175 years ago, they had everything, but they didn't have the necessary motivation to keep it going. And fortunate for us, we've had the hit and miss. We've had some of that. And it's our duty at this point to keep it going. We have the machinery in place. We have the jury. We have the courts. Let's learn what we can and see if we can get it to catch us and impel us forward. But the government in general, I would start to talk a while ago about notice. The general government in Washington, D.C. is to operate under the restraints of our Constitution of the United States. It sets limits. The government, the general government of Washington, D.C. is a limited government. Therefore, the courts have limited jurisdiction in the federal jurisdiction. The courts of the general government are limited to cases and controversies that arise under the Constitution of the United States. State courts, by contrast, are not limited. A state court can hear any case it wants to hear. Any case. Yeah, that's pretty wide. There may be an exception. I don't know what it would be. They can hear all the cases that the federal courts can hear if they will take jurisdiction. Now, there are some exceptions. There are some things that the federal courts have said, that Congress has said the federal courts have exclusive jurisdiction over. And when they pass legislation giving permission to sue the federal government, for example, in a civil rights action, they say things, the federal courts have exclusive jurisdiction over these matters, civil rights, under 1983, for example. But as a general rule of applicable everywhere, they don't. Well, the requirements for due process, notice, and an opportunity to be heard, the general government and the general courts of the general government, the Supreme Court of the United States, has said that notice has to be everywhere in the United States. It has to meet constitutional muster. But they said that's the general rule. And then they laid out what some of those requirements are. But then they said, and have said often, but if the states want to make the rules even tighter within that general wide requirement, that loose requirement, they can do that. As a matter of the United States Constitution, that's due process. And due process requires notice. And that means personal notice, according to what the Supreme Court has said about what the Constitution means. When it says due process, means notice to the other side. Well, then what's notice? Does that mean you can nail something to somebody's door, a complaint or a piece of paper? Well, the Supreme Court of the United States says, no, that's not notice. You've got to give it to them personally. And if they won't hand it, if you're standing in front of them, you've got to drop it at his feet. It's got to be personal. Then the question comes up, well, what if they go to your house and you're not there? Well, if somebody lives in your house and they live there with you, in most states, they'll take it further and say, well, if he's 14 years old and he's your son, he can accept service if he lives in the house where you live. The states can be even more restricting than that and make the notice requirement even tougher. But they can't make it less stringent than the Constitution of the United States requires under the due process clauses. Remember, due process most fundamentally means notice and an opportunity to show up at the place of battle and fight. That's what it means. Well, let's get to, I'm anxious, chafing at the bit to get into Article 1. Here we are. I'm going to read it. Article 1, Section 1, Clause 1 of the United States Constitution says this: all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives. Now, it's as important when you read a simple sentence like that. That's a simple sentence. Well, but this is important stuff. These are words of legal significance. And when you read words of legal significance, well, any other words too, but let's talk about words of legal significance. When you read words of legal significance, it is as important to ask what it does not say as it is to ask what it does say. It does not say, for example, it does not just go through and ask questions like this. It says all legislative powers. Well, does it say some legislative powers? No, it doesn't say that. That's important to notice. It says all legislative power. Does it say all legislative authority? Or does it say all legislative power? Well, it does not say all legislative authority. It says all legislative power. Okay. Herein granted. Does it say that it's granted any place besides the Constitution? Is it granted someplace else? No. It says granted herein. All legislative power this Constitution and herein grants is vested in a Congress. Is there any, does it say that any legislative power is vested in the executive branch of government? No, it doesn't say that. Does it say that there's any legislative power vested in the Supreme Court of the United States or the federal, the general courts, as I was trying to say a while ago, we call them federal courts. Does it say that any legislative power is vested in that? No, it doesn't say that. It is exclusive. It says all of Congress of the United States. And what is this Congress? Well, it shall consist of, it says, a Senate and a House of Representatives. There are two branches of this single branch, this legislative branch. A government has two branches. We don't say that in the United States. Now, in England, they say this. They say our legislative branch has two branches. It's a two-branch legislative branch. It is the members of Parliament, the House of Parliament. That's the lower house, which is an analog of our House of Representatives. And then over in Britain, they have the House of Lords, which is an analog to our United States Senate. We are both common law countries. Our government is a common law government. It has separation of powers, and it even has, and this isn't said, but it should be said, it has separation of powers in the legislative branch. The Senate and the House of Representatives are two. They combine wills to express two different wills. And if a bill ever passes from thence to the president for his signature, those two wills become one. It becomes one Congress. But the two branches have to agree. Now, this legislative branch, I'll say this, and then that's probably enough for today. But when, as you know, the legislation is something that the House of Representatives, for example, all tax legislation must originate in the House of Representatives. Our Constitution does not allow, and we'll get to this later, does not allow taxing legislation to originate in the Senate. And that was the big, one of the big arguments. It should be the big argument. There have been cases put forward. You see the Obama health care bill wasn't thought of as a tax bill. So the people that pushed it through, they ensured, because they thought it was the way they could do it quickest, they had it to begin in the Senate of the United States. And then lo and behold, it gets to the Supreme Court to see if it's constitutional. And Chief Justice Roberts said, yeah, this is a tax. Whoa, it's a tax? Well, let's go back and rethink this again. If it's a tax like you say it is, then for it to be lawful, it has to have originated in the House of Representatives. Now, there were a couple of cases after the first ruling that went back and filed and said, wait a minute, this is unconstitutional. And then I didn't hear any more about them for months. It's been well over a year now, I know. I don't know what happened to those cases. But that challenge should still be out there. That's unconstitutional. I bring that up as a footnote. But all of the legislation that's sent up to the president for signature, all of these things we do as a matter of process, due process, in the legislative branch and the relationship between the legislative branch and the president. All of those things are from England. And originally, the way it all happened was this. There was the width. I'm not going to go back to the creation of the world and bring it forward, but I do want to start back just briefly and make a mention of the way it was before the year 1066. The Witten, Witten is an old Anglo word that means white. It means wizened. That's the same root, wizened, white. And what it really means, Witten, means the white-bearded men, white-bearded. That means old men as opposed to young men. And our word sinnet, it's the Latin word that means old man. We even get our word senile from that root. Senate, senile. Seems like it fits sometimes. But it is the elders, sometimes called the elders. The Danes, when they got there, they called it the aldermen. We still use that word in America, aldermen, the aldermen of the city. Those are the elders, the older men. Well, during the time before 1066, before the Norman invasion, the Witten got together, and they called it the Witten Gemot, and those were the fellows that gave advice and consent to the king. The king didn't do anything under common law, that's the executive, without the advice and consent of the Witten Gemot. Gemot means meeting. Witten, white. Meeting of the white-bearded men. That's what the Witten Gemot was. Well, then that went on great, worked good, and that's common law government. Then the Normans showed up. Well, they shut everything down. But then William the Conqueror, which was the habit of the Normans, no matter where they went, they conquered Sicily, they conquered Constantinople. His brother was king of Sicily for a while, Roger II. These fellows went all over the world. They were a sordid bunch of piratical people. Just meaner than dog dirt they were. Well, and he got there, but the one thing they did do that was right, no matter where they went, once they conquered the land, the people, they said, whatever law you have in place, just keep it, and we'll work with it. Well, they did that in England. They said, and one of his first pronouncements was the common law of England, which they didn't call common law. They called it the Volk, Reich, the Volk, that's the folk, and the Reich is the right, which means duty. The Volk Reich is the people's duty, the people. There's that phrase again. But they took that idea and they said the common law is still in place. Well, that meant they needed to have an elder board, a board of old men. Sounds funny, doesn't it? Old white men, those fellows are not looked upon with much love anymore. And the older I get, the more I realize it. And my hair is all white, by the way. And I don't have a beard, but I know if I let it out, it'll be that way too. I'm getting worse? No, just whiter, whiter. They say I won't go there. But they spoke French. So they said, we'll have a meeting of men that parley. Parley is a French word. And because they get together and parley, that means they discuss things, we'll call them the Parliament. The Parliament. And it's been called the Parliament ever since. Well, the Parliament started to get together, these old men with the white beards. And when men get together, they discover they have common complaints and common needs and common problems and common grievances. That's why having a meeting like this on the telephone is not such a bad thing. The government doesn't like meetings because when people talk, then there's power and unity. They discover they have the same problems. Well, that's what happened. Parliament got together. It was a reconstitution of the Witten Gemot, but it had two branches and it had the imprint of Rome on it because of the Normans had been on the coast of France for quite a while. They'd become Romanized. They originally had moved there about 165 years before from Norway. But they conquered the area down there. They were conquerors. And Normandy became their country. Well, these fellows got together to parley, and they got to talking to each other. And they noticed in Parliament, where they parleyed, that they had common grievances. So what they did was they got together, and they would draw up something they were really concerned about on a piece of paper, and they would all sign it and send it to the king. And they called that, watch this, they called that petitioning the government. And that is, in modern times, the source of our right to petition. It began with the elders getting together and petitioning the government. And if the king would capitulate to their request or their grievance, he would sign the bottom of it and send it back. And that settled the matter. And that's how the custom arose. You see, before that time, really, nobody knew how to read and write much until the Normans got there. They had been, the one thing about Rome, they were administrators, administrative law. That takes paperwork. Men have to know how to read and write. Well, they could do all that. Before that, it didn't really matter. So those kinds of things, in principle, the common law had the same ideas. But this thing about writing and signing things and sending them back, and they got to call them that, a bill. And they'd send the bill to the king, and if he didn't sign it, it had no force. He didn't agree. That was one branch of government not agreeing with the other. But if those two branches agreed, the king, yeah, I agree, he'll sign it, then that became the standard in England. And we still do that yet today. And when the legislature, a Congress, or in the state legislatures, they finally agree, the two branches of them agree, then they send it to the executive. And if he agrees, he signs it. And if he signs it, it has what we call the force of a law, a force of law. Now, one more thing. Common law is not written down. But sometimes, and this is important that men do this, men write down what they think. And if the right people agree about something that's written down, it becomes law. And the important documents that are our organic law in our common law country, and in America, Congress has identified the Declaration of 76, the Constitution of the United States, the Articles of Confederation, and the Northwest Ordinance of 17 and 87. And they say these embody what we agree as Congress of the United States, all 535 of us, we agree that these comprise the fundamentals of what common law government is to us Americans. You see, in common law, we write down things like Magna Carta. They wrote it down and they all signed it. And as Winston Churchill said, that really was their agreement on what how the law applied at that time to the things, the particular things it talked about. And the same thing is true of our Constitution of the United States. It's not the Bible. As the Mormons say it's on the equal level with the Bible. I'm not going that far. I see mistakes in there, things that they tried to deal with, but it wasn't right. Well, sometimes they've been able to correct some of those ideas, but the other side of it is this, and by far and away, that particular document is really good. They made some astute observations. By the way, most of these documents that are really important in our common law tradition, Magna Carta, the English Bill of Rights, the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, the laws of King Alfred, the laws of Edward the Confessor, all of those, and the ones that really stand out were the ones that when the men took up their quills to scribe their names on them in their agreement, the Scottish Covenants, for example, and that's another one, the Covenanters, when they picked up those quills, the smell of gunpowder was hanging in their noses and men were trying to kill each other. That's the way it was with Magna Carta. The Pope of Rome had the army set in France ready to invade England to take it over. And the landowners and owners of England said, we got to do something. If John doesn't go with us, because John was going with the Pope, we're going to lose our country. Well, the same thing then was true with the Constitution of the United States. The same thing was true with the Scottish Covenanters. And these were blood kind of commitments. And that gives an extra punch to that word, the blessings of liberty. The blessings of liberty are about suffering to blood. Somebody must suffer to blood. And men have done that. Of course, ultimately, the only really good man that ever was, Jesus Christ, has suffered to blood. He took it all. And out of that, he says, my law, you can look at this in the book of James in the Bible, my law is the law of liberty. From the only true lawgiver, James says, the maker of heaven and earth and all that in them is. Well, thank you, John Gerard, and back to you.
My headset back on here.
Somebody's there.
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. I can hear you.
Okay, let me just get my headset
back on. Okay, we have a couple people still. Thank you, Brent, by the way. A couple people in the queue yet, so I'll go ahead and pull up the first one here and see what we got. Okay. You're coming in as anonymous, so give us your first name and maybe your state. Go ahead. You're unmuted.
Hi.
Oh, I know that voice. How you doing? That's
okay,
Crystal, right?
Yes. Okay. I sent over the form 38.
Okay.
Okay, and we put a letter together, and because we found out in our state, I think there's over 33,000, which they're all, I guess they're all, you know, involved with the state and what have you. When we've been going to the court and stuff like that, I also sent over the last 8 pages of a transcript when I asked the judge, when they said, we're going to take your property, I'm in the appellate court. He again went over the appellate court, and when I went to court on Monday, last Monday, he said, well, we're not going to, we are not going to rule, I cannot speak on the other two claims because they're in the appellate court. I said, all three were in the appellate court. He goes, well, I'm not going to hear your case because I already ruled on it, so We're moving forward to vacate your property. Now, remind you, I have my warranty deed, my quit claim, life use, everything. Ironically, when they called me in court last Monday again, the attorneys and nobody showed up. Now we have another new attorney that they're going to be bringing in. So I guess because us all being on TV 2 weeks in a row with Senator Blumenthal, I guess, and people are all calling in the same. They're getting undue attention they don't want. So we've got the form is 38 about. The foreigners, the attorneys are foreigners, and so I sent it over to John, and then we put a letter together. And it's a standard letter that everybody basically can use all around the country with that other form, and they have to fill it out and send it to Washington. I think the expiration date is 2020. I can't remember right offhand, but anyways. We're all filing complaints, and also with these illegal foreclosures and this WPTA, and I told everybody just follow with put it in writing, get an affidavit, do the a grievance on the attorneys and the rest of them, and mm-hmm. send them up. So make sure that you know because I think this is going to be very very helpful to everybody. You know.
All right. Hey, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
When you say you go to court and none of the attorneys showed up.
Yeah.
So what does the judge do? Look, if you have a court date and you don't show up, you know what they'll do? They'll rule against you because you're not there.
Exactly.
So if the attorneys don't show up, that's a default judgment on your part.
Exactly.
You should be able to get up and say, well, I don't see the party for the other side. I'm ready to move ahead, and Your Honor, you have to dismiss this case because they're in default. You have to rule in my favor. I mean, they have to do that. And the other point I want to make is all these foreclosures, as far as I can see, that are going on, and mostly they're widows, people whose husbands died. They're living in a house that they've had for years. they're stealing the equity out of these homes. This is RICO.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wants to move you along quick. I mean, you need to make the point that these houses that they're taking, you don't owe hundreds of thousands of dollars. You owe maybe 5 or 6 or 10 or some paltry amount compared to the value of the home. So they don't want you to sell the thing and get your equity out of it because you could. You know what I mean? You could do a short sale
and make more money than what's due on the place in most cases, and probably 99% of the cases, there's enough money left in the equity of the house that if you set up a short sale, you would walk away with, you know, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $50,000, $100,000 in your pocket. But you see, they want that. That's what they're stealing.
Well, see, not only that, because it's the Federal Reserve, and whenever you purchase a property or whatever the case, your property is already paid for almost 10, 15 days after it. Secondly, I said, who signed my name and who changed my mortgage? I said, every time I said I noticed, and this is because my property was paid off, and then they turned around and put their name on my property 3 years after it was paid off. I said, who signed my name? I said, it's a matter of fact, that's the work I used to do. And and then when I asked, because I said all the questions, who signed my name, any case over, anytime you put a case together, they have a year and a half to prove their case on both sides. If they don't, the case is dismissed. You can't even have a case. I said, I sat there and proved all my evidence, proof of claim, show me due process, who signed my name. I said, until this day, and I did the subrogation, I said, until this day, you have not prevailed or not answered not one of my questions. There should be no proof of claim. I said, you had a year and a half. I said, she's right. Almost 4 years. And I said, the case should have been dismissed. I said, secondly, I said, I asked for a common law, jury. I said, anything over $20, that's my constitutional right. I can have a common law jury. We also found another letter pertaining to that. Also, there is an article I did send over to you today, too, and it's the Dario. Their family just won $111 million on the RICO charge in Connecticut. In Hartford, Connecticut, they have the most there's 42% of the people in Hartford, Connecticut, which is a state capital, that lost lost their properties. 42% properties and businesses. Okay? Who's getting them all? It's the attorneys. In our local city, there's over 70,000 people that are homeless. I said, who is the injured party? I said, families are being broken up. And then when they're taking the kids from the parents, they're getting their DCS and all them. They're getting over, they sent about $3,000 to $5,000 per kid. Keep the families in the house. They had the audacity to have on the news the other day, oh, we have a lot of homeless people, and we're giving them package cares of toothbrush, toothpaste, lotions, and we're trying to find a place for people to live. I said, wait a minute. People would have a place to live if you stopped stealing their homes. And then with all these vacancies, so what they're doing, when they vacate the property and they have the marshals to put them out, then they turn around and say that the people abandoned their property. Okay?
Right.
And one particular case, I think I shared with you, the people owned the property, and we found out that this no-good attorney who's been stealing the people's properties and selling them, and that's MERS. And what happened, I guess he got caught up in the storm of this illegal foreclosure. And what happened, I said, well, go back and get a sworn affidavit who and why this other company is stealing the property. So sure enough, he sat there and said it was this attorney. I said contact the bank. No, it wasn't even a bank, because there's over, I think it was like 30,000 mortgage companies, which anybody could be a mortgage company. And they bid on the properties. This guy, guess what? He got this man's home for $5,000. He was the highest bidder. So I guess he did contact the owner of the property and said, can we talk? So I guess they're trying to do a transition, you know, because now they're all getting in trouble because they sat there and changed the people's mortgage. How can you change a mortgage or the deed when you got the warranty deed? Who signed? So it's so much crazy criminalness going on.
Because they don't even know the law. They're just used to doing what they're doing, and they're
exactly.
not looking for deeds.
Exactly. So that form, make sure he gets that, and then there's that RICO that, and, you know, the biggest corruption case is going on up here in Connecticut. So
now these are mostly mortgage foreclosures, not tax. These are banks and mortgage companies, right?
Yeah, they're stealing everybody's property, exactly. You know,
so
and like once
they're rewriting the mortgage or they're making second mortgages on it, and then they're defaulting them, huh?
And no, they're just stealing people's property. I had no mortgage on my property. I told you, they went on November 7th, they sat there and put this crazy company, put a lien, and then the 13th, they put the GE Credit Union on my property. Then the following week, they put me in foreclosure. They started the foreclosure. And this was all in 2014. I said, who signed my name? Show me proof of claim. Where's the contract? You know? And until this very day, from November of 2014, actually, it was June of 2014, show me the contract. When did I sign anything with, to this day, they cannot bring up anything, you know? And then with the other companies, because I put claims, I said, where did the money go? There was no mortgage even be paid, you know? So they did the release, of course, you know what I'm saying? Because I caught on to it. But see, the average Joe Smo would have picked that up, but that was the work I did, so, you know? But as I said, he got there's the forms that everybody needs to follow through on those and send them right into Washington. There's the attorneys in them have to fill it out because when we sat there and checked, their names aren't even what do you call it? Their names aren't even registered.
You know, part of the scam, somebody revealed it while we were on here one day. I don't know if it was last week or week before. They said that when you pay the mortgage off, there's a spot there for you to accept the deed, and it's left blank. These companies come back in. It's a negotiable instrument. They can renegotiate it, and that's what they're doing. They're renegotiating it and putting a mortgage back on it because you never signed the thing and accepted the deed as paid in full and yours. So the attorneys are going, this is an attorney scam. They're going back in, and they're putting their name in there. They're putting their bank name, and they're renegotiating the mortgage, and they're putting more money on it. This is bad. I mean, this is RICO.
Absolutely,
you know?
And I think the fact that
there's a lot of equity in these homes is another big damning thing against them, because look, if somebody's gonna default or whatever. Usually there's no equity in places like that because if there was, they'd take a loan or they would sell it. Mm-hmm. But you see, they're coming in and they're taking a home that's perfectly, what do I want to say? It's a good home. It's alive. It has equity. It could be turned into something. And they're stealing houses that are not defunct, that are not abandoned, that they're not short sales. They're buying them for $5,000 and they're worth $110,000 or more.
It's a Ponzi scheme what they've been doing, and it is a RICO.
Absolutely.
But I have my warranty. If I wanted to put Mr. Magoo on my property, I also patent my land. So I got my volume and page on everything. I said, who is going to sign and remove my name off of this? Okay? And I said, I got life use of 100 years. It's going to be on a trust for a grant for 500 years, which I could leave it as heir property, okay? And everybody needs to put that in their property, heir property, and they have the life use of it, you know? And, you know, it's just like what's going on right now because of all the worldwide disasters, especially out on the West Coast, Connecticut, the East Coast is like the new Hollywood. So all, even though those people have lost all their property, a lot of them still got that cash flow. So they're buying properties up here for $800,000, $900,000. So guess what? We're going to take everybody's property because we can make big money now. Eminent domain. There's two things for eminent domain. The only reason why you can take people's properties is highways and trains, you know? Otherwise, they're perpetrating the fraud, and they're stealing everybody's property on eminent domain because the money you're going to make is high-risers, you know? And so yeah. It's the land that they want.
Yeah, they really stretched that eminent domain. They rule that if they can take a piece of property and make more tax on it, that that's an excuse for eminent domain,
but,
and that's absolutely a fraud.
It, of course it is. And see, one guy, he won, oh, my God, they put a fire department on his property. After they put the fire department on there, he went right back and sued the city on eminent domain because he knew the law, you know? Some people,
right.
You know, and guess what? For the rest of his life, his kid's life, his grandkid's life, for the next 1,000 years, they got to give him a check, you know. And there is no statutory limitation on that.
Because it was fraud.
Exactly. So with all this, as people don't realize it, but the next another thing that's getting ready to happen in January in our state, and probably, I don't know, is the reevaluation. So if the homes are going for $400,000 or $500,000, and now the new people from the West Coast are coming in and paying $1 million for the house next door to you or whatever
right.
of the property, now our taxes are going to go from maybe if it's $10,000, $12,000, it's going to go to $70,000. People are on fixed income, so they need to grandfather and put a freeze on all the residents who live in that state and also a freeze on the rent. So the people that can afford that kind of money, will let them eat up the new cost. Because any state that has a lotto should never have a deficit. And all this, every state has, where is the money? People don't ask the right questions.
That's what they did in California.
I'm sorry?
In California, I think that was Proposition 13, where they froze the taxes of people
mm-hmm.
that were already there, and they couldn't raise them above whatever the level was. In, I don't forget what it was, 19.
Okay, because, see, when I started working in my job back in the 70s, there was a freeze on the elderly, you know? So
mm-hmm.
every time there was a reevaluation, you know, they were frozen in that property up until their demise. But, see, now with this, and you got a lot of celebrities that are moving in here and businesses, so they're squeezing everybody and taking everybody's land, you know, because we're not far from the city or Boston, what have you. And as I said, this is absolutely crazy, you know.
Yeah, well, we see that's what's going on. Listen, I got Jim in the queue. I want to get him before we go.
Okay.
And he may have something pertinent to say on all of this. So I'm going to go ahead and unmute Jim. You can just kind of hang out there. I'm not going to mute you, but go.
All right,
okay.
Just make sure you get those papers. Everybody, put that out there. We've, you know, you've got them already, okay?
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Crystal. God bless you. Jim.
Hi, Gerard.
Hey, what's going on?
So I called in earlier, and then I heard my name later on, but I couldn't talk, and I was trying to get on, and I dropped the call. So what was that all about? Can you give me the lowdown?
John was talking to you. You got to go back and listen. John was talking to a woman, and he wants to do a habeas corpus, but he wants all her information. So he was going to have her call you, but he told her to call Jan. But it's gonna fall in your lap anyway. So.
Yeah, no problem. Okay.
Info. What's that?
I got some info. I took the note that I pasted in Jan's thing and put it on yours in Skype, Jim.
Okay. Yep.
Okay. So,
so you can check that.
You have that. Good. Okay. So that takes care of that. And I don't know if there was something else we wanted from Jim. I feel like it was a long time ago.
I hear a lot from Crystal, and I'm wondering. I like what she does. She tries a system, but I mean, I thought we already came to the conclusion until we're in Article 3 court. We're just not going to get any justice, you know? Just seems like she's just tilting windmills. I'm not trying to discount her. I'm just trying to get some ideas. I thought we already tilted this windmill, you know?
We know that when we go in with a direct suit, that they don't honor common law and they play with their statutes. Now, if you know their statutes and you know the game, and you get good enough at knowing your enemy, you can get them in a horned dilemma, and you can win. People do win. It's not easy. Crystal is so tenacious, and she's been in there so long, and they're committing so many crimes. At some point, it gets ridiculous, and they realize that they've exposed themselves, and that's how people win today. You wear them out. You know what I'm saying? It's not that you can't never win in their court. Look, she should have won the first time she went in when they're violating her due process, but they keep playing games and trying to push her back, and they won't let her in the federal court. They're saying that she's a serial, you know, bankruptcy person, and they've tried just about every trick in the book. Thank God she's articulate, and she is somewhat, you know, of elderly, that they have a little bit of respect. You know, it's not like she's some young kid in there screaming, and she keeps her head. And so, you know, she has more composure than the judge does sometimes, you know. So basically, she's in there making them look bad is what it is, you know. And she brings people in. You know, if you want to win in these courts, you can't do it alone. It's like Thornton says, court is a show. It's a play. And if you want to win the play, you got to bring the crowd with you. What good is it if you do a good play and nobody's watching? The whole point of having court watchers and people there and having court is that it's a trial in the public, like Brent says. You know, it's either by sword or with the judge or whatever, but it's a contest, and people have to be watching that contest. And so Crystal does very good at bringing blood in there, young blood, old blood, fresh blood, people who are tired of, and the, if there's one thing that the judges are sensitive to, it is that political action of the people. You know, I mean, the parties run a lot of stuff, but the judges understand that they can't tick off all the people all the time. They're going to, and their time is getting shorter now because, you know, they're doing a lot of bad stuff, and that's why you have such security around the courts, because they want the judges to feel comfortable, you know, pillaging and doing what they're doing, and that there's going to be no consequences, because it's getting so bad that, my goodness, they're going to have to take the judges out in tunnels, secret entrances and exits, to get them in and out of the court so somebody doesn't kill them on the way in there, because that's how bad it's getting, you know what I mean? But anyway, things are good right now because we have this top-down situation, and Donald Trump saying that he's turning the sovereignty back to the people. That anybody that's in court, that's good news, because that means they're going to have to start paying attention to us. You know, at some point, these judges and prosecutors that are cooperating in RICO and evilness, they're not going to get away with it. And, you know, hopefully they're, you know, and I think there's a lot of concentration in New York and in the Northeast and Connecticut. That's where, not to say that there's not a lot of corruption out West, but these guys in the Northeast have been at it since Washington's day. I mean, they're really serial abusers, all of them, and they've long established themselves, and they've laid roots down, you know. I mean, they go all the way back, these families, and this crap that's been going on, these political families running dynasties, and that's what we have here in the Northeast. And the nice thing is that Trump had to operate in New York City, and he knows them all, and he knows the game, And I believe that he's attacking them where it hurts. And so that means that the pressure that we put in the courts may actually start to show some results at this point. I think that in the court systems in the city down there, you know, the Southern District and all that, I don't even think they're completely awake yet as to the danger that's coming down on their heads from the executive branch of government and the military. They haven't even, they're just starting to realize that they're in trouble. When that full realization comes and they start opening up indictments on these people and they start to run like rats from a ship, I think that we're going to have a field day. I think that's when we need to be in the court. Because I think that's our time to really put our redress in and then stand there on common law, because this is something that the federal government, Donald Trump, the military, they need the people to be behind them. They need to be behind the people. And this way here, it shows that they have a mandate of the people. Look, if we're all in court with grievances and we got these cases and everybody's paying attention, it gives them a perfect excuse to say, listen, we're coming in to clean up, because look at this, the people are pissed. And basically, that's our job. That's the job of everybody here now, is to ratchet up and lever these courts so that the heat goes up and they can't stand it. Look, they got pressure from the top. I know they do. I'm watching the alternative news and special, you know, news that if you're watching the TV, you're not getting it. You're not going to get it on the TV at all, you know. So you have to watch that alternative news and get yourself some sources that you trust, you know. And I mean, the case in point, and it's almost time to go, but was when that reporter asked Putin, do you know of any collusion with Donald Trump? And he says, no. He says, but I do know of collusion with Hillary Clinton, that she got $400 million. He said it was only $400,000. I think there was a correction there. That agents of the FBI and the NSA helped her with this Russian guy who owes me money, and she got it tax-free. Not one news agency in America other than the alternative news, not even Fox, nobody brought that up. That should have been on headlines all across the nation. That was a major, major bombshell that was thrown out there, and nobody picked it up. That's an indictment against the national news media, the Mockingbird News. They didn't even talk about it, not a peep. I mean, when something like that gets thrown out from the president of Russia saying, I know, and he said officials, he didn't say agents, he said officers of the FBI and the NSA. And an officer is somebody who runs the agency. It's not an agent is an operative, and they're not necessarily, you know, they don't have a mandate of the government. They're not operating under the law like officers are. So he said officers of these ABC agencies facilitated the illegal deal, the tax-free illegal deal that the Clinton Foundation, Hillary Clinton, and this other Russian guy has done. I mean, that's just a scratch of the surface. That's just the beginning of what's going on. And none of the news media has talked about it. So that lets you know where we're at. But I guarantee you that they're going to use that as an indictment against the news media, as they should, because that was major. I'm sorry.
Can I put in a plug for Patriot Soapbox?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I want to encourage people to learn what Discord is and go over to YouTube, look up Patriots, Patriots, Soapbox, Soapbox, and just listen. It's on 24 hours a day, and they cover a lot of this news that you don't get. And you can turn it on, listen as long as you want, turn it off, and turn back on another time. And just listen and see what you think. and then get involved if you feel you should. So there you go. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a lot of alternative news people, a lot of movers and shakers in the Patriot community. And it's not only Americans, it's people from all over the world. There's Australians there. There's people from Ireland and Britain, all people that want their common law, and they're looking to America. You get a whole different perspective because you get a worldwide view of what people think of us and how people are looking up to America right now and Donald Trump. And, you know, they do a lot of the decoding of the Q stuff. And right now there was a massive push by the Mockingbird media to discredit the Q things, but they never address what's actually going on the Q post. Because what's going on the Q post is whoever's putting Q out is asking questions. He's not telling anybody anything. Why did this happen? Why did that happen? Ask yourself this, ask yourself that. And what you find out when he does that is he shows you, and you can tell when certain things happen, because he's doing this predictive questioning, and something happens, and it's something he already brought up that confirms the point that he made, and it has to be military intelligence. You just know it is, and it makes sense. And what they're doing is they're educating the people. And the reason that they set this whole Q thing up that they're calling a conspiracy theory, it's a conspiracy thing about, it's not a, whenever the news media says it's a conspiracy theory, that's exactly what's going on. That's what they want to steer you away from. And they never address the issues that are brought up. And the military intelligence and Donald Trump were very, very smart by putting this up like it is, because what they're doing is they're educating a whole big section of society so that when the indictments go in, that there's going to be people that know exactly what's going on, why it's going on, who's going to jail, and why they're going to jail, and that they will not be taken by surprise. So, you know, they're picking up, 5,000 new people every day. So this whole awakening is going through the world. It's not just the country, it's the whole world. And it's starting to go viral. And you need to pay attention, people. You need to go out there and educate yourself and listen to some of this stuff and get involved. So anyway, it's 12:01. And it's been good. And thank you very much. And we'll be back here next week. So pray for the country. You know, we're at a very critical time now because things are coming to a head, and the deep state and these operatives, and we all know who they are, you know, are backed in a corner now, and so it makes them very dangerous. They're apt to do anything to keep from going to jail, and they got like one foot on a banana peel and the other foot in Gitmo, and that's where we're at, folks, right now. And things are going to start getting real exciting here in the next month or two. Everybody said, well, when's the arrest? Well, arrests have been going on, but you just haven't seen Obama and Hillary get arrested. There's the whole rat line under them that have been getting arrested. They've arrested actually thousands of people in this whole pedophilia ring, and there's a lot more charges, treasonous charges, that are going to be coming out. And the funny thing is they're so lawless and so debased that they're all involved in this horrible child trafficking thing. It seems like it bit all of them. So if they don't go down for the treason they did, they're going to go down for the children that they've decimated. They're going down either way. Just like Al Capone, they didn't get them for taxes. I mean, they didn't get them for murder. They got them for tax evasion. Well, they're in a similar situation. They're going to go down on one hand or the other hand or both hands. That's what they're facing, and they know it. Look at Sheldon Silver is in jail. He should have went for life. They gave him 7 years. That no good snake that owns the biggest law firm on the East Coast, who was the Speaker of the House of New York, is in jail. If you don't think that means something, and that happened 2 years ago, that was the beginning of the avalanche, of the tidal wave. It's happening, folks. Pay attention. And don't be surprised. And the other thing that can happen is you know, the economy can go down. So just be prepared. Be prepared that we're going to maybe go through some rough times here, because they're not going to go down without a fight. And that's where we're at right now. This is war. It's happening all around us. You listen to what's going on. And look, at you can listen to the Mockingbird news media, but you need to know what's going on behind that, and you'll understand how ridiculous they are, how angry they are, and how desperate they are. And with that, I'm going to close, and may God protect our nation and protect Donald Trump and the military that is doing the job of fighting. They're really powers and principalities. They've sold their soul to the devil, these people, and that's the fight that we're up against. Okay, with that, I'm going to say good night, and God bless.